at times is becoming farcical. And you have to really feel for these players and management. This isn't normal in any shape or form.
For your first chance to hear Brian O'Driscoll on OTB, download the OTB Sports app and turn on your notifications.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
Sam Robinson's done it again! Deflected shot from the edge of the area, straight into the back of the net!
So Callum Robinson against Michelle Barsham, down to our right-hand side, in front of that large group of Republic of Ireland supporters. Robinson, right-footed, into the back of the net, low down to the left-hand side. Callum Robinson on the double once again. Republic of Ireland 2, Qatar 0, and there's not even 13 minutes on the clock. It's Jeff Hendrick, slides it through to Robinson, chance for Robinson! Oh. Hat-trick for Callum Robinson! What a beautiful goal from the Republic of Ireland. They must have strung 20, 25 passes together. The most patient of build-up. Conor Harran takes it. Outswinger. Duffy goes up. And Duffy scores. The Ireland captain makes it 4-0 before the hour mark. Conor Harran's corner kick. And Shane Duffy rolls highest on the edge of the six-yard box. Heads it down into the ground. He loves a goal for the Republic of Ireland, and he's got his sixth in this, his 49th cap, and what a night it's turning out to be for this Irish team. Republic of Ireland 4, Qatar 0.
Yeah, 4-0, that's how it finished in our beautiful, beautiful blue jerseys with the amazing crest. What's that face for, Kenny?
No, I agree with you.
You do? Oh, you. Finally.
I thought you'd come up with a better adjective than beautiful. Like, I was waiting for the big punch.
No, that's it.
It was a bit underwhelming, right?
What would you have gone for?
It was punchy though, the jersey, wasn't it? I don't know what I was expecting. I wasn't expecting that shade of blue. I'm not sure what I pictured in my head. But when I saw it, rocked me a little bit.
So I think it should be our away jersey. People are saying the white jersey has to be for a clash of colours and all that kind of stuff. But like, use it when we can. Bring it in. Bring it back. It's cool.
Home and away. Let's stick with it. We're on a roll.
Green's
overrated.
Whenever I see a new jersey, I go onto Twitter just to make sure that it is nice, because we've had this conversation before. I never know if a jersey is nice or not, but everybody was in agreement last night.
What I didn't like, amazing. I was looking down from the stand at the lads lining up for the anthems, and I don't think the orange boots sit too well with it. Yeah,
right.
It was just Andrew Omobamidele had the blue boots with the kit.
Nice.
Oh, nice.
Sharp.
He knows what he's doing.
Sharp, yeah. The lads just, everybody's just got to roll it out.
A step ahead on and off the field, our Andrew. Yeah. Right, look, we are basking in a bit of glory this morning. I just want to bring you this. Kieran Cunningham tweeted this last night. Against Georgia 4 years ago, Ireland made just 79 passes in the first half. There were 38 passes in the build-up to Callum Robinson's third goal tonight. 1,900 likes on Twitter for Kieran Cunningham's tweet. We played good football last night. We're not getting carried away.
Oh, Jer, come on. Let's.
We're not getting carried away
from the old good football debate. I enjoyed the performance.
But it was good football with the result. Because the knock on Kenny was, what's the point of this? There's no end product. And now there's end product and good football. And the crowd shows up.
Yeah, it was good football.
The jerseys look good.
Yeah, you're right. It was good football because we mixed up our game, didn't we? We got on the ball, we made passes, we got the ball back to front early. Jerry, we got the ball in behind them, we turned them, we put crosses into the box. So it was difficult to pigeonhole that performance as, it was just like a possession-based, just looking to keep the ball and slowly move up the field. We mixed it up well for me. We actually played smart football which I enjoy watching the team playing. So it was good decision making for me from people in possession. You know, we went backwards and sideways and we had to maintain possession, but we hit the front men at times early. We went down the sides in behind them, the pace of Chiodosi, Ogbeni in that first half, Jamie McGrath, who's quick in his feet. Interesting, the dynamic between the front three, I thought it worked really well. Callum Robinson playing that central striking position, dropping off the front into those kind of deep pockets. The likes of Chiodosi then and Jamie McGrath looking to drive into the space in behind. Jeff linking up well from that central midfield area. So there's really a lot of positives from the performance. In possession of the football, like you're saying, you know, creating chances, looking like a goal threat, scored more goals. Yeah, it was really good. Really exciting performance in that respect.
Yeah.
I know we've got Nathan on the line, so like we might just throw this to him. But like last night kind of felt like the most positive night at the Aviva. I'm not saying that we're getting carried away with the result in terms of the opposition, but the most positive mood at the Aviva since maybe the playoff win against Bosnia. I know you've worked at both games, Nathan, so I'm not sure what what your take on that was.
It was definitely a night to remember atmosphere-wise. They've done a lot around the Aviva, I think, in terms of the pyrotechnics and all that to build an atmosphere before the game. But the fact that it was the sellout, the fact that it was over 25,000 people there, and it was Qatar, and it's a Tuesday night in October. If there was a reason not to go, there were plenty of them last night. But you sense that when the team came out, when Stephen Kenny came out, that the fans wanted to show Stephen Kenny that they are behind him, that they do believe what he's doing. But I think everyone feels the same thing. They believe what he's doing, but he needs results. And last night they got it, and it was a really effective performance in terms of the style of play. As Kenny said, it was noticeable at times. They were very calm, I thought, at the back. They slowed it down when they wanted to slow it down. They weren't afraid to go long at times and try and stretch Qatar and put them on the back foot. And there was a proper cohesiveness, probably with the exception of maybe 20 minutes before halftime, where the midfield sort of lost the run of itself and Hendrick and Harahan went missing a little bit. And it's not really either of their gigs, that sort of holding role. But the fact that from the first 30 seconds of Bene, when he won that free kick in the first 30 seconds, the crowd were into it. And there was an intensity from the performance that was sort of unrelenting, which means they're the nights that as supporters you love. And I know, Kenny, you're not, don't want to talk really about styles of football or the right style of football or the wrong style of football or all that. But I think that intensity is what fans want more than anything else when they go and watch Ireland. And it's what's been lacking over the last few years, that it's been dull. It has been dull. Friendlies are generally dull, but even the competitive games, not a lot happens. Ireland stand off a little bit. The other team has the ball. Whereas they got at them last night. And then they tried to do the right thing. And they scored that goal that Callum Robinson scored to complete his hat-trick was an exceptional goal with the patience that Ireland showed. The Shane Duffy. Like Shane Duffy is the one. Just before that bit of commentary, I think I said that all 10 Irish outfield players within 40, 45 yards of the Qatari goal. Shane Duffy just skips around a player. He's confident because he's the other two centre-halves there to do it. Plays a nice little ball and he continues his run is the thing.
Yeah.
Shane Duffy then is the furthest Irish player forward. Makes almost a decoy run and it's just the perfect way to pass from Jeff Hendrick, who's had one of his best nights in an Ireland jersey. The finish from Callum Robinson. And you know, who knows what goes on at board level, but I think last night and the last 3 days will have gone a long way towards securing Stephen Kenny's future.
And rightly so. Now, here's the thing. My main problem with us having to talk about giving Kenny the new contract over the last while was that we didn't actually get to talk about the games and the football itself. Now we're going to get, hopefully, to talk about the games and the football itself and the evolution in the style and where we're getting to. There's still issues, Kenny, right? Qatar created a fair few chances on the break without actually troubling the goalkeeper that much. They could have, with better forwards or better midfielders, have shot and scored against us. So this is something that we need to work on, that continuing issue that we have there.
Yeah, I think that's the one caveat. I think the kind of the defensive setup in this particular team over the past two games hasn't been kind of stress tested by the quality of the opposition, but that was a pretty miserable performance last night from Qatar. They really surprised me, actually. I was expecting a lot more from them. That said, that's not the takeaway from the Irish performance. But yeah, I'm very interested in terms of the performance against Portugal on the flip side, really, in terms of how strong that defensive setup is, because if there is a small worry over the course of the past two games, it's in terms of just maybe our defensive qualities, particularly that kind of central area of the pitch, and not just central midfield but collectively as a unit, in terms of how strong we're going to be. Can we absorb pressure for longer periods of time against far superior opposition, which Portugal will be, and to a certain extent Luxembourg in that final away game? I'm not exactly convinced of it at the moment for the reasons you said, Ger. Just getting caught on transition a number of times over in Azerbaijan, and even last night on a couple of occasions, just kind of vacating that central midfield area, which is understandable because you've got some of the likes of Jeff Hendrick, who for me, you don't want to hold him in that central midfield area. You want to let him go and join up with the front three. He's so productive in the final tour, such a good technical player, which we saw last night in abundance. So you actually want to encourage him to get himself a little bit higher up the pitch. That puts a huge amount of responsibility on the shoulders of the other central midfield player. And in Cora Hurahan, for me, again, I don't see somebody who's a naturally holding central midfield player. I think he wants to drop in there at times and spray passes and get their passing going, which I think he can do. I think his distribution is the best that we have in that central midfield there, actually better than Josh Cullen in that respect. per se, but as a comparison to Josh Cullen, I think he's very more tigerish in the tackle. He brings more of a physical element to that central midfield, Josh Cullen, in terms of getting around, making tackles, making interceptions, more of a defensive mindset. So that'll be interesting in terms of how Stephen Kenny sees that kind of partnership, if it is going to be a partnership for the game against Portugal, if he's going to go with the front three and a midfield pairing, who he feels best complements each other in that central midfield.
If Cullen's fit, Cullen plays. He's his first choice, right? So it'll be Cullen plus one. Is there any possibility that actually Hendrick plays in the McGrath role, and that, you know, for games like Portugal?
No, I think Jeff looked at ease in that area of the pitch when we were in possession of the football.
He's a number eight.
Yeah, he is. We're going to play as a two. Yeah, whatever number you want to put at him. But I just feel as if we've got to be realistic in terms of what we can expect of Jeff out of possession. He's not a bit of type to get around to make tackle after tackle.
Okay, so that's why you have McGrath on the team.
I think it's what happens around Jeff when you haven't got the ball. And I think if you have Jamie McGrath, and I'd agree with you, I think Jamie McGrath's pushed himself into the reckoning for a start against Portugal in one of those front three positions, Callum Robinson another. The debate may well be who's going to have that tour position. Will Alameda come straight back into the team? Callum Robinson off one side and maybe Jamie McGrath. You could see that potentially as a front three of the game against Portugal. But I think it's collectively how you make Jeff's performance last night. For me, you're looking at it, and we haven't seen that type of performance from Jeff, Nathan, have we, for quite some time. The last two games we've been crying out for it. People keep referencing back to 2016, but it does seem that long. It's far too long for a player of his ability, and he's put the type of performance in the last two games, particularly last night, where you look at him now, Jeff, and you think, right, he's got to stay in the team, we've got to keep him in the team, but we have to kind of protect him a little bit when we haven't got the ball. So that'll be the challenge for the management staff in terms of when we lose possession, how do we get players around Jeff to a certain extent and just protect them, you know, and have a really solid kind of defensive base from which to work from. It might mean we actually take a step back. We play more of a lower defensive block. We get the likes of Jamie McGrath, Callum Robinson in those wide positions and get them to drop in alongside Josh Cullen and Jeff Hendrick in a real kind of narrow midfield four. And that offers a lot more protection to our kind of midfield too. So now you've got a back five unit. You've got a narrow midfield four in front of them.
That's what we do in a game against Portugal where we're going to have 30% possession.
Yeah, well, I think so. You have to respect the opposition. You have to respect the fact that You have to factor in terms of the qualities of the previous two teams we played. You can't be blind to the fact that maybe the small weaknesses but that we saw in those two games.
How does that tally with the desire to press, which like is the thing I think that is kind of innate in us? We want to go and push forward and we want to attack.
Yeah, but you might have to temper that because like I'm saying, you say go and press. So press with the system at the moment, you've got to send your front three players really high up the pitch to go after the opposition defensive line if they're looking to play out. Now good teams will make little angles, a little combination, and work the ball in around that front three. And once you get past their front three, which you've seen in previous games, that really exposes now your central two midfield players. They've really got to shuffle across the pitch and do a lot of kind of doggy work. There's a lot of defensive responsibility there, and I'm not too sure that Jeff and Josh Cullen punishment centre midfield, I think that's too much of a stress for them. So for me, the argument would be maybe not such a high press game against Portugal, maybe drop into a lower defensive blocks, keep those number 10s, whoever they be, Callum Robinson or Jamie McGrath, Daryl Horgan, whoever they might be, drop them back into a deeper defensive shape and maybe look to play sacrifice a little bit more possession.
Yeah, I understand that. I do, and I can see how that would be the debate. The only thing is that we're trying to build this style where we are a high press, high energy.
Yeah, but well, don't get fixated on the story we're talking about. What was our percentage against Azerbaijan? What was our possession percentage? 36%. Was it? You know, don't get fixated on. We've got to have a possession base.
No, I'm not fixated on the possession. I'm fixated on the press. Yeah,
we don't have to be a high press.
But the press creates the chances. We turn over in a high.
Like, yeah, but you can create chances from a. The press can come 10 yards outside your penalty box. The press doesn't have to come 10 yards outside the opposition penalty box. Yeah, you could argue that's ideal because if you win it back 10 yards outside the opposition penalty box, smaller distance, you've got to travel to the opposition goal and get a shot on target. Yeah. But there's an element of risk to that. This is what I'm talking about. There's an element of risk to operate that kind of high press.
Is the long-term reward for trying this against Portugal in a pressurised situation, is the long-term reward for that better than actually... Because we know we can...
It doesn't have to be one or the other, Joe. Jared, it doesn't have to be one or the other. Like I said, it's just good decisions, having the team set up, being tactically
astute. So you do both
within the
game.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Lads, you call it yourselves at that particular moment in the game. If you want, we're going to go a little bit braver, higher press, everybody's got to come up the pitch. That means our back five have to get up to the halfway line. That nice compact defensive shape. But yeah, let's go at them. Are we going to have a little bit of joy? If they play through us one or two occasions, do we recognise that and then drop into that kind in a lower defence. That's interesting for me. That's not any type of criticism. That's just as I'm seeing it going down the road against stronger opposition who we're going to be playing against.
I wonder, was one of the things, Kenny, the fact that Portugal basically didn't have a midfield against Ireland in the first time? It might be a little bit unfair in the two that they played there, but they had four attackers on the pitch. Like, if I recall correctly, they had Bernardo Silva starting, they had Jota starting, they had Ronaldo starting, they had one other starting who I'm forgetting right now, but they definitely had four attackers. Go on, Nathan.
Bruno Fernandes,
sorry, of course. So it was essentially a situation where the Irish midfield weren't going to be outnumbered in that situation, and maybe that's poor management from Portugal to not see that. Maybe they got off the hook a little bit in that regard, and their midfield kind of survived that way.
Yeah, but that's when you've got to be bright, you've got to be intelligent. Players got to recognise that on the pitch, you've got to see those pictures on the pitch, and they've got to take responsibility. Can't always be looking to the touchline to your manager and coach and staff. Oh, they've changed, he's playing, we weren't expecting him to play, they've tweaked their formation, what do? We press, do we not? And that's when you kind of game intelligence really comes into it. Players recognising the situation, what's in front of them, and actually organising things themselves on the pitch.
Well, is there a case for the Portugal game that actually Hendrick doesn't play, and that you play Jason Knight and Josh Cullen, and suddenly you've got high energy there non-stop? And
I think it's an argument for, I'm talking about tweaking it, I think it's an argument maybe for playing a narrow midfield three against Portugal and sacrificing one of those front three and going with a central two.
Okay, so who would that be? You stick Knight instead of McGrath.
Potentially so. Absolutely. Yeah, that could be an argument. Jamie
instead
McGrath,
of either, maybe McGrath plays. I don't know.
He can play as a number 10, but I've seen a Jamie McGrath, when I've seen him play in the League of Ireland football, he can play as a 10 just behind a central striker as well. So what I'm saying, that's actually quite exciting for me. That's not quite a negative now. I don't want this to turn into a big kind of a negative spiel. It's not. It's actually quite exciting for me because we're working, nothing's changing at the back. We've got that solid defensive three. We got our two wing backs. That's kind of set in stone now. And now we kind of build from that. And we can make one or two little alterations ahead of that and tweak a couple of little things. And fundamentally, the whole shape of the team doesn't really change. The kind of style of football that you're talking about, philosophy, whatever you want to call it, that doesn't necessarily have to change either. You're just making small little adjustments depending on what you're facing at any particular time, and that can change during the course of the game at any moment in time. Players can make those small adjustments themselves.
Yeah. Nathan, what was the post-match like? What was the general sense? And cause, I mean, the vibe around the team was incredibly negative when we were in the midst of COVID. They couldn't train with each other. Players were sitting in the wrong seat in the plane. All of a sudden, the HSE were ringing saying you can't play that player in a big match, and it was a disaster. It was a real complete shit show, and it looked like there was a stench of doom around the place. I presume that has transformed.
Absolutely, and Conor Hourihan was out after the game talking about how it was probably the most enjoyable game he played in an Ireland jersey because of the amount of touches he got, how you were always getting on the ball, and that's as a midfielder what you want, and too often he probably hasn't had that opportunity. And I think Howard's an example of, in a way, how Stephen Kenny's been fortunate with the senior players he's had in the squad, who are all really good professionals, who were never really going to turn on him, whether it's Seamus Coleman, Shane Duffy, James McLean, Conor Hourihan, who I think probably kept that ship just on and kept it away from sinking over the last year, because if any of them had come out and sort of expressed concerns publicly or shown any cracks within the camp, it would have been a huge deal. But I don't think with those four in particular that was ever going to happen. And I think there has been a transformation over this last week. When you think this morning, last week, we were, you know, in the depths of Callum Robinson's press conference, and you wondered what was going to happen over the following days. The squad seemed to have come together. After that, they've come out and protected their mate. He's obviously rewarded them with his goals as well. And Stephen Kenny, I think you could sense there was a relief for him last night. He started talking about the future again. His grand plan, it turns out, was for the Nations League next year, to win the Nations League group next June. Which would,
a bit of a hostage fortune.
A guaranteed playoff.
Wait until the draw gets made and we see who we've got.
Exactly. You don't want to be in a position where actually you've had a decent Nations League campaign. You're going into your final game away at Iceland, needing a win to fulfill this prophecy. But Stephen Kenny's contract is for those games. It's after those matches in June his contract officially finishes. So I think he was just trying to get out ahead of things once again, and maybe even push back that decision to next June as to whether or not he should get a contract extension. But results like this are always going to change the atmosphere, and I think will change the expectation as well, particularly for the game to Luxembourg, that like Ireland now have a goal scorer in Callum Robinson. And of all the players, without going over all ground, of all the players he has missed over the last year, like Callum Robinson has been the one. Look at the matches he's played in and look at the Irish performances. He played over in Slovakia, started the game, played almost the full 120 minutes. Outstanding. Plays in Serbia in the 3-2 defeat, you know, comes off with 10 minutes left, but again makes a real impact in that game. even the match against Serbia, where, you know, unfortunately he can't play in that game, he's not fit enough to start in that game, comes on, he provides the cross and the one where they kick it off the other player's arse and it goes into the back of the net. Every time he plays for Ireland, he's been able to make a big impact. So if they can keep him fit, they can keep him starting, maybe at long last we can, I don't think we're ever going to stop the Robbie Keane conversation because he's never going to be Robbie Keane, but you have a player who might be able to get to 20 international goals, which would be a massive step forward.
Right, here's what's coming up between now and 10 o'clock this morning. OTB AM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We're going to talk with Conor O'Donoghue about the potential windfall that Plan B would be for the GAA. One of the knocks on Plan B has been we don't know how much money it would cost, is the story that's been put out there. But we believe that the maths stack up, and he's going to explain why. He was on the committee that actually came up with Plan A, Plan B, Option A, B, and status quo. Michael Deignan, the Offaly County Board Chairman, All-Ireland winner and obviously influential Sunday game analyst, is going to join us at 8.15 to give us his view on it. We'll bring the sports news at Will at 8.40. We're talking about the Premier League, which is back now. We can all relax, exhale, and we don't have to talk about the Ireland team. We don't have to have civil war for at least a couple of weeks.
We don't want to relax, really, do we? We want to stay in this kind of euphoric state a little bit longer.
Keep the foot in the throat.
Yeah, no, you're
right. What are you trying to do, Jerry? What are you trying to do?
And Nicole Turner is going to join us to talk about her silver medal in the Paralympics around about 9:05 this morning. Here's Stephen Kenny talking about Jeff Hendrick's performance. Have a listen.
Well, it really is dramatic. You know, like, I don't mean that, but Jeff went through a period when when things weren't really happening for him, and so well, but he has every, like, he was absolutely outstanding tonight. Complete all round performance in every facet of play. His energy around the park, his vision and his first touch and his understanding of his role within the team, and definitely this sort of the space, playing with only two in midfield and this with the three wide players, that gives him a lot of, it suits him, really suits him, that position. And he's really just been, you know, that's one of the best games I've ever seen him play, to be honest, and I think I thought he was really, really, really exceptional to him.
Now, the one cloud on the horizon is obviously the club situation at Newcastle because of the takeover. Jeff Hendrick might not get a game for Newcastle for a while, and his contract is till 2024. So the alternative is that he really benefits from the fact that he's going to be playing with better players.
Yeah.
Well, as was pointed out last night, Jer, I think it was by Gavin Cooney, his new Saudi Arabian owners will be more than happy with his performance against Qatar.
The geopolitics, he'll arrive to work and there'll be a brand new Lamborghini for him.
Yellow. Blue.
Blue, Irish blue. You'd love to see these players playing week in, week out and coming back in form. That was the thing.
Yeah, let's not get too caught up in it, though. You know what I mean? I get a bit tired. Well, he's not getting his game time. I can understand that little bit more, to be honest with you, with the younger players who are kind of still developing, need that kind of game time. The likes of Adam Mead, Aaron Connolly, etc. I think that's more relevant there. For me, the more experienced players are like Jeff Hendrick and one or two others, I never worries me so much,
right,
in terms of, no, I'm not getting the game to now, because they're smart, they're experienced.
Up and play.
Yeah, I think so. You get to a certain age, you know your body, you know what you have to do. You might be getting that competitive football week in, week out, but you can tune yourself mentally, you can get yourself in the right place when you come together with the international squad. I think Jeff's one of them.
Okay, that's interesting, because like at various stages, different managers will, I think, invent a narrative. Oh, he's not playing well for his club, and so therefore, yeah, I'm not picking him. So it's just
too much play on that, I think. Right. Too much play. And I think each player's individually with a different kind of makeup mentally, I'm talking about here. Some players will come with the international squad, younger players in particular, if they haven't had, not getting their first team football, it'll affect them a little bit, their confidence. They won't be in the right place mentally where they feel they should be coming into a camp. Others, it's not so much a problem. They'll walk through the doors. Yeah, give me the jersey, I'm kind of ready. So you just got to assess each individual player. But the more experienced players in particular, I don't think that's so much an issue.
Okay, well, one of the things that we wanted to ask you about, Kenny, was how do you take the exactly what we were just talking about there, how do you take the spirit that the camp feels at the moment and apply it to the next camp, because it's a month away. It's totally different. Everybody goes away. They get into their real world. They get back to the day job, and then they have to come back and go, oh, I remember now. Everything is amazing. Well, how do you do that?
There. You don't package it away. It's either there or it isn't. It exists or it doesn't. So, yeah, like you're saying, we're all on the outside looking in. Nathan, me and you really have no great contacts within the squad. Nobody talks to me these days. I don't get the skinny on anything inside the squad. But yeah, you do get a bit of a sense of that. Like I said before, I've never seen a player come on openly media-wise and criticise his manager or, you know, what's going on behind the scenes. But sometimes you get a bit of a sense of it around the place. Nathan, no better for me, being a journalist. But yeah, you get a bit of a sense. There has been a bit of a more of a coming together of late. There's a decent atmosphere within the squad. So that augurs very well going forward. And I liked the mix last night. I looked at the team last night. A lot of talk about the youngsters, the amount of young players who are being blooded. But that's kind of very well balanced squad at the moment. If you look at experience in the squad, all those youngsters we could look at last night, Nathan Collins coming onto the pitch, fantastic. I must admit, any time a player comes on for his international debut, it kind of, you know what I mean, it gives everybody a surge of electricity looking at it. So great to see him come on. But you've got the experience of Shane, John Egan on the pitch last night, Enda Stevens, Jeff Connor in central mid. These are players of vast experience. Shames has got to come back into the squad as well. So there's just like the makeup in terms of the squad,
Kenny,
at the moment.
Aren't they? Like, they're playing well. You go through those players individually, yeah. And I'm not going to say it's the best they've ever played for Ireland, but Seamus Coleman, until the injury, looked back to his very best. Yeah. He was making a real impact in attacking positions. Matt Doherty obviously should have twice the 25 caps he has, but again, looks incredibly confident despite his lack of game time. Like, Shane Duffy utterly transformed from where he was 6 months ago. John Egan rock solid. James McLean, a lot of people thought was
finished,
gone, that yeah. He was finished, he might
but his
get
performance
the
in the night
and
was
keep
excellent.
Him involved. But well, this time last year, Enda Stevens was probably one of the few players who was 100% assured of his place in the team, whereas now Enda Stevens is coming back after 6 months out injured thinking, well, James McLean has come in and really impressed. And also, if Seamus Coleman is fit, he's probably going to want to play Matt Doherty at left wing back. So there's competition there as well. Like Jeff Hendrick we're talking about. I think actually Hendrick has been really good consistently for Stephen Kenny, maybe not quite like last night. And then like Callum Robinson maybe is the one who makes everything click. The one thing, Kenny, I wondered, is there a danger of overreacting to last night, because Jeff Hendrick was brilliant.
A bit like you've been this morning.
But he played in a free for Stephen Kenny as to how he gets that balance of what he believes from last night's performance. So Hendrick was outstanding. Yeah. He sort of had a free role to do whatever the hell he wanted. And yeah, Ireland afford Jeff Hendrick to have that role, not even against better opposition, but in a proper competitive game? Is there a midfielder, does Josh Cullen being there allow Hendrick to have that role to pop up all over the park and have a real impact?
Yeah, well, like I said, that is very interesting, because you want to get the best out of Jeff. Now, you've got to give him that freedom, haven't you, to kind of vacate that centre. You can't tell him for the whole 90 minutes, stay behind the ball. We have possession, stay behind the ball in that central midfield area. Just present yourself as an outlet. If the ball is going to come backwards to you, just keep the ball kind of ticking over and just kind of, you know, just efficiently move the ball sideways and around the pitch. You want them at times, encourage them to get beyond the ball, you know, and get in contact with the front three and even get beyond them and even get within 10, 15. Yeah, big difference playing 20, 25 yards from your front three and 10, 15 yards. You get that close to them, you can play like little 1-2s, clever little balls around the corner. We saw where Callum Robinson's third goal, you know what I mean? He got to within 15 yards of Callum Robinson, then he's punching that ball down the sides. So you want him to play in those areas, Nathan, don't you? But I'm talking about experience and players, and Jeff's going to have to show that experience maybe against Portugal a little bit more and pick and choose his moments, really, when he makes those calculated decisions to get ahead of the ball and get himself involved. Because what we can't have is him getting himself ahead of the ball, us giving away possession, and Portugal breaking quickly at us, where he just can't regain that defensive shape, and suddenly big pockets of space are opening up, particularly down the centre of our midfield. So again, that's just game management, Jeff using his experience. And like I said, that performance last night, you really feel as if Jeff's got to stay in the team. The qualities which he showed. Now, Stephen was very complimentary, yeah, in terms of performance, and I buy into that to a large extent. But when he's talking about every facet of his game, I don't think those defensive attributes which I'm talking about were really tested last night against that Qatar team, but they will be against Portugal. And then we'll see whether we can carry Jeff and that team in a midfield too, and with three out and out attacking players playing that kind of high press game which Jair's talking about there, or whether we need to kind of modify our approach a little bit, Jeff individually and collectively the team as well.
On the topic of getting potentially a little bit carried away with the events of last night, You refer to Callum Robinson, Nathan, as maybe a situation that we now have somebody who can score goals, and he's probably better than everybody else in the squad. But if you look through Callum Robinson's career, while he's been an outstanding player, and this includes for the Republic of Ireland, goals haven't necessarily been part of his game. Goals have been a part of his last two matches for Ireland. Like, he's only 26, and we're going to get a hell of a tune out of him over the next couple of years. But like, is that tune definitely going to involve goals, Kenny? Because it hasn't necessarily been that way for him throughout his career.
Well, I agree with you. I think it's a good point. So it wouldn't surprise me if Callum Robinson goes six games without scoring a goal. Because I think that's how his career's been up until this point. And if you look at those the last couple of games, Nathan, five goals, you think, oh, this is absolutely breathtaking. Obviously, the penalty last night. Obviously, everything at the moment, you get into these pieces of striker, everything you shoot on target, you score. So there's the significant deflection for his first goal. I'm not looking.
Three out of the four were deflected.
Yeah, exactly. Even that third goal last night was a brilliant goal. The number of passes you were taught about, etc. But that's actually a significant deflection off the foul. I don't think that shot's going in. It deflects off the
defender
goes past the goalkeeper. But you shoot, you don't score. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But you just get a sense of at the moment he's in that, he's just in that space where everything's happening before it's going into the back of the net. So yeah, I think there is a degree. Let's not get carried away. Now we found ourselves a new Robbie Keane. We haven't. So I still think there's an onus on other players around the pitch when you set up your team. Not to be focusing on Callum Robinson now he's a given for a goal every game now. That's not going to be the case. We've got to put a team on the pitch where you look around the pitch and think, you know what, we've got goals in different areas. Jamie McGrath, can we get a shift out of him? Can we get a goal out of him? Our wing-backs. I thought James McLean's second half against Azerbaijan was great, not just in terms of his overall performance, but how he attacked the box, particularly when the ball was down the other side of the pitch, attacking that back post. You can see potentially James chipping in with a goal or two if he plays in that area. Matt Doherty as well, Seamus Coleman. When you play with wing-backs, they have to offer a threat in the last third of the pitch in terms of goals. So he's not the answer. Let's not get caught up in thinking we found...
I have one last thing on this now. Go on, Nathan, quick.
I was going to say, he might be as close as... to an answer as we found, and actually the confidence from this 3-4 day spell that he'll now bring into the next international break. Because you look at his career, the problem is when things have gone well, never got a run. So the last year when he got those couple of goals against Chelsea on two different occasions, 2 weeks later on both times he's back on the bench for West Brom. But actually now he can come into an Ireland camp and go, I'm definitely going to start here. Yeah. I know I'm in that starting 11, and the confidence that brings, I think, maybe transforms him.
I think he's one of those players who would actually benefit from playing a lot of football and actually scoring regularly at championship level. But just in terms of the influence of Anthony Barry, and we've only got a minute for this and we might come back to it a little bit later on, can you see the fingerprints of the coaching ticket on the team and stuff that he's brought to it? Like, even just the creativity around some of the set pieces. I don't want to completely overblow it, but it was just interesting to see there was a wrinkle. We switched the ball from one side to the other, and there was a nice little turn that ended up giving, I think it was either John Egan or Shane Duffy, a free header at the back post. The execution at the end wasn't great, but three or four times we actually had two or three players arriving for the ball with a free header and getting in each other's way. That suggests the work is beginning to show dividends.
I'm not too sure, to be honest with you. That might be a bit of a stretch. I just don't know. It's a simple answer to that. I don't know Anthony Barry personally. Again, haven't heard too much feedback in terms of input on the training pitch. So I don't really know is the answer to that. I mean, if you look at the goal last night, the corner kick, wasn't a huge amount of imagination involved in that. Outswing a ball from Conor Hiran into the box. Shane Duffy sticks his head on it. I think it's more so maybe in terms of the general setup of the team. I mean, there's an argument, if there is an argument there in terms of us settling on that back three kind of win-back system. People make obvious comparisons to Tuchel at Chelsea in terms of that particular formation, 3-4-3, which Chelsea employ. Now, I think that's a bit of a jump. Chelsea play that way, we're playing this way. Oh, clearly, Anthony Barry's the common link. I think that's too far of a stretch. In all honesty, so yeah, you would like to think so, that he's been brought in for a reason, I'd imagine, in terms of the qualities which he has as a coach. So clearly I'm hoping he's had an input, as Keith is there, and obviously the other support staff. I'm sure Stephen will say it's a collective effort on their part, but yeah, we're certainly in a good place, and there's a lot of cohesion to the play now, which is good to see. Playing with a real kind of tempo, there's a real kind of template. You're looking at the team now in terms of how we're setting up. You're seeing nice patterns of play now emerging as well. So don't think it's perfect. I think there's actually more to come, which is quite exciting. But yeah, I think we're in a good place at the moment. It's good to see.
Yeah, all right. Kenny's staying with us. Nathan, well done. That was good to get the notion that you're some kind of a curse around the place when you're commentating on the Ireland team, and we always give away last minute winners or just don't win games we should win. But I'm glad that you've managed to kill that rumour.
Finally. I think it's the first Ireland victory we've commentated on in about 2 years. So, yeah, Stewie was delighted. Kenny's the curse as well. I see him at all these games also. So you could put it on his shoulders if you want.
It was yours that were the ones that we were...
I'm a denominator.
And the other stat from today in the paper, I don't want to mistake this now, but that was our first penalty since Robbie Brady in 2016.
Yeah.
Mm. It was John Fallon, I think, in the Examiner had that.
And to get a penalty last night was some doing because, dear God, that referee let a lot go.
He should have let that tackle go.
Must have fouled Callum Robinson about 14 times and never got a yellow card. It was a slightly strange refereeing performance. Yeah, first penalty since Robbie Brady. Here's one for you, just to keep an eye on for future Ireland internationals. From what I can tell, I'd love if a listener got involved and was correct me. From what I can tell, no Irish goalkeeper has ever saved a penalty at Lansdowne Road.
Ooh. Well, we'll put that out there. 5 minutes past eight this morning. Nathan, good stuff. Thanks very much for that. We're going to take a quick break.
Lads.
We're going to ask the question about the special Congress, which is coming up in 2 weeks. There hasn't been that much about the economics of the whole thing until now. Will Plan B boost GAA's revenue? We're going to find out next.
OTB
AM. Okay, we're going to hear from Michael Dignan in just a couple of minutes about the special Congress, about the future of Gaelic football. But I'm delighted to welcome back to the show Conor O'Donoghue, who was part of the committee that came up with the original options that are going to be put to special Congress, and who joined us on the show last week to strongly endorse option B, plan B, whatever you want to call it, which will essentially flip the league from spring to the summer, and that'll be the competition that everybody enters to try and win Sam Maguire. Conor, good morning to you. How are you?
Morning, Ger. How are you doing?
I'm good. I see from the papers this morning, and in fairness, the Irish Independent are leading with it on the back page with the numbers that you've crunched, which was kind of an answer to the question that was posed by Brian McAvoy in the show and in other places. People are saying, we don't know what the financial implications of Plan B are. You sat in studio and said, from a financial perspective, it's a no-brainer. You've gone and crunched the numbers and done the work to try and put some meat on the bones of that argument for us. So maybe just give us the top line and explain to us how you applied the logic and then what the results were.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Ger. Look, I mean, numbers were done before and certainly gone through, and they looked really, really good from a financial perspective. So I suppose this is just about putting real, real flesh on bones in terms of some of the assumptions that are made. But the bottom line is that if the league is championship format was in 2019 and 2018, based on very, very conservative assumptions, I would say you're talking about 8 million extra, roughly, on average in central council figures, and you're talking 2 plus provincial bodies. So you're talking a total of about 10 million or thereabouts that would be added to coffers. And really the reason for that, Ger, I mean, it's exactly as described before. It's just the quantity of games. It means everyone is playing every week. It's not Dublin and Mayo, for example, that are playing 7, 8, 9, 10 games per annum. Every county's playing it. Every Division One county is playing it. So even allowing for significant reductions in attendance, just the quantity, as Napoleon says, is a quality all of its own. And it just means that those summer games, there's so much more of them. That is going to result in extra revenue, undoubtedly.
Okay, so that's nice, short and sweet. Just to go back and parse that a little bit, the provincial councils are, I think, the ones who are most concerned about the erosion of the link between the provincial championship and the All-Ireland, but also the money. That was the other thing that came through. Like, this is Turkey's voting for Christmas was the direct quote from Brian McAvoy. In your estimates, the provincial councils will actually be better off under Plan B.
Yeah, and again, it's the same. It's the same thing, Ger. I mean, there's very few provincial games. That's the reality of it. They're all knockout games. They're one-off games. Will they, on an individual basis, attract more paying customers? Sure, absolutely, no question about that. But the fact that you're multiplying the number of provincial games by roughly three or thereabouts, it just gives you so much more scope to take revenue in. And provincial councils, I mean, particularly Ulster, you'd have to say. Where interest, again, we've spoken about this before, will be focused and concentrated, even allowing for some pretty, I would say, concern. I just think these numbers are going to be higher. But we're talking about 65-odd% additional versus the 3-year average revenue in the last years before COVID. So I mean, for me, again, the number of games here is gonna be your friend from a financial perspective. You don't need huge attendances to make these numbers work. You just have a lot of games, and again, ticket prices. We're talking fairly muted ticket prices versus even what we know the cost of an Ulster final is 35 odd euro. We know the cost of a Leinster final is 40 odd euro. But even allowing for relatively modest numbers, you're still talking about significant increases. And again, the number of games here is your friend. In Leinster, I suppose, I mean, to be frank, Dublin is clearly the financial monster in the room. And when they play, their revenue or their obviously their spectator numbers are much higher than everyone else's. And you have to assume that they would be thereabouts in Leinster finals again for the next couple of years. And again, if you're talking any sort of, I'm from Meath, and Ger, I know you're looking for Kildare to do a little bit more in the years to come as well. I suspect that those Leinster final numbers, etc., could be higher too. So, yeah, it's again, forget about anything else in terms of the standard of the competition. From a financial perspective, this makes an awful lot of sense.
So you took the available audience figures, attendance figures for 2018 and 2019, and applied a logic to what might happen. What kind of a financial or what kind of a numerical formula did you apply to try and come up with what the crowd figures might be for a summer championship?
So for summer championship, we had a look at the Super 8 games that were there. And we know in the Super 8 format, given there's no consequence to the last number of games for about half the teams, some of the attendances fell off. We still use those numbers. And on average, including double headers, so we halved for double headers, around 18,000. And the 2 years were quite consistent. The attendances started strong and fell away as a consequence. But we used that as a number for Division 1. What that number might apply across the board. Just to sense check it, we did a separate calculation just to see if we handballed every single Division 1 attendance, what it might look like. And that number came out at about 20,000. But we used the smaller figure, the Super 8 figure. And then what we did was, what happens in National League typically is the Division 1 games tend to obviously get significantly more revenue. Over a couple of years, you can see that the step down is about one third or 33%. So we stepped down Division 2 attendance figures to get you a number of about 5,000. And we stepped it down right again by one third on each occasion to Division 3, Division 4. So by the time we got to Division 4, you were talking about a couple of hundred spectators, which didn't make sense really from a champ. So we stepped that up slightly to about 2,000 spectators for a summer championship game in Division 4. And then we applied that across the board, used ticket prices of 20 euro and 15 euro for Tarleton Cup. The Super 8 ticket price are 25 euro. We're trying to allow for students, OAP, juveniles, etc. And that's what we arrived at. And again, just to reiterate, Ger, it's the number of games that's your friend. There's 112 summer championship games. So will numbers be lower than knockout games? Yeah, absolutely, no question. But will there be enough people to make this work? Yeah, I think so.
And the key point in that, Conor, is trying to assess games that were of consequence. And you mentioned there a couple of the games without consequence in the Super 8s, which I think people have used as a prism to view Proposal B through. And I crunched some of the numbers last week and came up with the fact that there was 4 out of the 112 regulation games in the last full National League that was played in 2020 that were dead rubbers. So it is a tiny percentage of games that won't be of consequence, actually a far smaller percentage than in the Super 8s. Then the other thing, Conor, just to add on before you finish up here, is that this isn't a full financial picture. As you say, you're being conservative enough here in your figures. But then in the other bracket, you have sponsorship and media rights, which, given the extra volume of games, is surely going up.
Yeah, and I spoke to one of the most senior commercial figures in sport in the country over the last week. And I mean, he's shaking his head and just saying, listen, there's so much scope there. I mean, the big thing clearly from a sponsorship and a media rights perspective is clearly live television and what happens there. Because live sport with Netflix and all of the rest is where it's at in terms of advertising. And there's just a big opportunity set there. And there's nothing taken into account on this as well. And I've spoken to a number of figures on this space, and they may join you at some stage. But it's that side of the revenue numbers are completely unexplored. And I'd say that's another exciting source of revenue. And just to be clear on this, I mean, the GAA puts all of that money back into the association. I mean, it doesn't give anyone a share bonus or anything like that. That money goes back to counties. So those funds can be used by counties. We could talk all day about the season tickets and how that operates, but I won't even go into that this morning, guys. But again, those funds go back into the association when they're generated. So this is a big opportunity set for the GA.
Okay, Conor, good stuff. Are you happy enough for us to publish the detail of your proposal? Because I see it's in the papers today. Yeah. And I think it would be good for it to get out there and be circulated and let everybody kind of parse through it and in typical Irish fashion take shots at it. But I think you've robustly defended it. And I see certainly there's a consistency to the logic the whole way through that should carry any of those arguments.
You know, absolutely, that can be circulated. It's no problem. I mean, to stress test it, it needs first division attendances to go below 10,000 for summer championship games. So Dublin games, Kerry games, it needs to go below 10,000 Division One and below 3,000 Division Two. So that's the Meads, the Corks, and that's at an average ticket price of €20 before it starts to just do exactly what the previous championship did.
Yeah.
So, There's significant scope put in that as well.
Okay. Conor, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us this morning. Cheers.
Thanks, guys.
That's Conor O'Donoghue there, who was on the task force. I'm delighted to say we also have Michael Dignan with us this morning. Michael, good morning to you. How are you?
Yeah, good morning, lads.
We've been covering this story now for a couple of weeks and kind of there's a few other people who have been covering it, in fairness, the same length of time, but it hasn't quite taken off, or maybe it's just about to take off as a discussion point. The GPA came out last week. I think, If I'm right, counties like your own were kind of gestating on the information and looking at the presentations that have been given and coming to a conclusion. So what's your instinct about how big an issue this is going to be over the next week and a half in particular?
I think it should be very big, Ger, because I think it's very, very important. I think it's an opportunity to change the direction of the football championship for the better. That's my own personal opinion first. I come back to the county's opinion in a minute. I think as a player, and I played for a long time myself, you want to be playing championship matches in the good weather in the summer. It's a huge opportunity. And particularly when we see the lopsided nature of matches over the last... It has always been that, I suppose, the GAA. But this is an opportunity for teams to play meaningful matches against teams of their own calibre. And we've seen over the last number of years, the National League has really caught the attention of the people, and the players enjoy it because they're close matches. And we're also not losing out. We're not losing anything. We're not losing our provincial championships. We're not losing, you know, our All-Ireland series. It's just a different way of getting there. And what it's going to do is give players, supporters, opportunities to go and play week in, week out in the good weather for crowds of people to get out and go to the matches in provincial venues. And to me, it's very, very positive. And it's certainly well worth trying. And if there's tweaks needed, I just see some commentary that maybe there's a few tweaks needed before maybe bring it back next year. But, you know, I think you can go ahead with it and you will learn. There's never, I don't think, a system brought out yet that is perfect at the start. But it's certainly going to be, in my view, way better. One of the big concerns from a county board point of view, and if you take in our case, we're in Leinster, the provincial council in Leinster Council have been so supportive of counties like ourselves, that going back to Michael Delaney's time in Leinster, Michael Reynolds now as chief executive, you know, we wouldn't, you know, we have fantastic facilities in Offaly O'Connor Park. The Faithful Fields would be our biggest project. And John Horne was chairman of Leinster when that kicked off. And without his support at the time, that wouldn't have happened, because he was the first, the Leinster Council were the first people who said, look, we have this grant aid for you here, and made that happen. And now we're in looking for six coaches at the minute. Leinster Council are behind us again. There's a few roadblocks at the minute, with redundancies, etc., in the association, and it's just delayed slightly. But again, they're fully supportive of us. So I think the one thing, and Conor has, you know, Conor's report there, it'll be very interesting to see how that's... but this is very late in the day, I think, for the financial implications or the discussion to be coming out, because there's been no information passed on. And there is a fear in provincial councils that they might lose some of their independence and that ability to support and to you know. So what I would have thought was it would have been very sensible to guarantee a sort of maybe an average figure over maybe the five pre-COVID years, to guarantee that sort of income to the provincial councils as a first point, and then if things are exceeded, then you can provide extra funding. But I think that's created a little bit of a fear. And even last night we had a county committee meeting, and that was just one of the things that the delegates asked us to get more information on was you know, what would be the financial implication for the provincial council, and to make sure that they weren't put in in a position where there's concern over their ability to operate independently of Croke Park. So in overall, I think it's very positive. We've been in touch. Our players met on it. They came back to me, the players' reps, and they're 100% supportive of Plan B. I met our team management last week, John Mahon, Tomás O'Shea, and the lads, and they're again fully supportive. And our county committee, then county management and county committee, are also behind Plan B. But as I said, there was some concern over the financial implications.
Okay, and does what Connor's saying, I realise it is late in the day, but is it too late in your view to carry the day? Because if the figures hold up, and it would be very easy for Croke Park to come out and say, yeah, they do hold up, and also very easy, your idea is a great one, and I think it makes perfect sense to say, over the next 3 years, we're going to run this experiment, we'll make sure that your income is the same, at least as it was, because centrally we believe there's going to be an opportunity for us to generate more funds. We think you might even generate more funds locally yourselves, if Connor's maths stack up. That it's worth trialing for 3 years.
Absolutely, I think but again, you have to realise you're dealing with, you know, an association that is relatively conservative and a little bit afraid of change. So I think and there's still time, as you say. But I think the Uachtaráin, you know, generally would have to keep maybe out of this, you know, in terms of giving a personal opinion. But I think maybe, you know, I think Tom Ryan could come out and discuss some of these issues and give some surety around them, because anyone that I've been talking to realizes. Well, I know you've had some different views on the program, particularly with Munster, but you know, people, if you're being realistic about it, like, you have to listen to your players, and they're the ones that, I wouldn't call it a sacrifice. They want to do what they're doing, and I always, you know, I think, go back and ask any county player. It was the best days of your life. You really enjoy doing it. But it is a huge commitment. And why not listen to them? You know, because as far as I can see, I haven't heard Annie, and you can correct me on this, but I think, you know, it's been fairly unanimous among the players, among the managers around the country. And I think, you know, on a trial period, what have we got to lose, especially if that financial sort of surety is given? So I would encourage, you know, people to think along those lines. I can't speak for any other county. We're all independent, and we think along our own lines. But we have certainly considered in great detail at Offaly, and, you know, a wide range of people, as I say, from our management committee and the county board and our delegates last night, right down to the most important people, our players, and then a wide range of people on our management. I met 11 members of the management and backroom team the other night, and we had a very good discussion on it. And we just think it'll be revolutionary in terms of the enjoyment and of the opportunities. I know there's downside. There are a few things. Look, you know, you can be second in Division 3 or 4 and get promoted, and then someone else could win the Tottenham Cup and you might go up and things like that, you know. But there's little tweaks that would be, and maybe some of them aren't so little, and they might emerge during it, but you can always change those.
Yeah.
So I just think it's a fantastic opportunity to show a bit of leadership, a bit of forward thinking, and bring a bit of excitement back in, because, like, nobody wants to see a continuation of these hammerings that have been going on over the last number of years in Championship. And just look at the average losses that some of these teams are taking. And if you want these lads to continue to play inter-county football and put in the time and effort that's needed, you want to take their views very, very seriously now, because we could look back in a few years' time and where life is changing, society is changing all the time, and maybe players won't continue to put up with the status quo.
Yeah, I can actually see a situation where somebody plays under county and then doesn't go back to their club because they're so fed up with the game itself. And look, you know, we're in the realms of speculation there, but it's not a guarantee that you'll continue to play a sport where you're getting humiliated in public representing your county when it was your dream as a child, and actually you end up getting beaten 30 points by Mayo or Dublin or whoever it is in the situation that we have at the moment. Can I just ask you what actually happens now? So as a county, your executive have decided that you're going to be in favour of it. How many delegates do you guys get to send to Special Congress, and are they specifically mandated then on the day to vote for Plan B?
Yeah, we have three delegates. We normally would have five, so it's reduced, obviously, because of COVID. So myself, the County Secretary, and our Central Council delegate. Yeah, so we are mandated now, and I suppose we're entrusted by our delegates now. As I said, the only caveat was that it should be forthcoming, because is to get some, you know, more information around the financial input. But as far as the proposal goes, yeah, Offaly GAA will be supporting Proposal B.
How much would it help a county like you, your delegates and the delegates of other counties, Michael, to hear somebody higher up in the GAA give the thumbs up to maybe the figures that we heard this morning and say, yeah, that all stacks up and this is all in the clear? Just that extra sense that might give people a bit more trust about the whole thing, because that seems to be the issue here.
Yeah, it's not really trust. It's that, look, our relationship in Offaly GAA, and look, we have, I suppose, it's a bit unusual that some of our funding will come from Croke Park, obviously, you know, in terms of how the division of funds, but your relationship on the ground on a day-to-day level is with your provincial council, you know, with Michael Reynolds, with the coaching team, James Devan, Adam Mulhall over there, with John Brown on the financial side. They're the people that really, you know, that you know better, that you're working with on a daily basis. So those, I'm also on the management of Leinster, because there's four chairmen that revolves every year, and it would be I think people would might think it's you know, maybe the provincial council trying to protect their own patch. It's not that at all. It's on the ground, the work that they do with the clubs, with the county. You know, James Devan, the coaching officer that looks after Offaly, would be around to, you know, and down on the ground as part of this process that we're going through to try to build our coaching on the ground. And as I say, we have, you know, we have five coaching staff at the minute, two GPOs. We have an application gone in and accepted by Leinster for six more GPOs, and we're hoping maybe another two or three next year. But we need the expertise and the support and the HR element of Leinster to do that, because we don't have a HR element. Like, it's a huge, I think, advantage for the Dublins, and I know I often wonder how they must have their own HR. Cork, I think, looking at the staff they have, and maybe other counties have, but we don't have the resources to set up a HR and employ people. So we depend on Leinster for all of that. Then if we're doing developments in our clubs or everything, Leinster's and Croke Park as well would be involved in terms of grant aid. But, you know, it feeds up through Leinster up to Croke Park. So that relationship, that whole system, it works. It works really, really well. So I think if people, you know, I think if it is certainly a fear on the ground in provincial councils that they may lose, you know, some control, some of their own autonomy. And to answer your question, I think it would be massive. And I think, you know, there's a responsibility on the GAA to come out and sort of answer that, because there must be some cost analysis. You know, we've heard from Conor this morning. There has to be. And as you mentioned there, the commercial side, the TV rights, you know, the opportunity to build on this and to really promote these matches in the provincial towns, maybe some Friday night matches, Saturday evening matches, you know, which can bring great life and great energy to the communities. So I think, you know, a good strong statement from sort of the hierarchy. And, you know, sometimes you have to put your neck in. I know it's down to the thumbs, but, you know, you have to say, yes, look, we think this will be good for the association. We think that this will be well worked. And I say, you're only talking about a three-year trial. The GAA has been around a long, long time. It'll be around for a long time to come. So I can't see any downside in getting in behind this and really supporting our players and what they're looking for. And as I say, we're all looking for really. It's not just the players, but I think, you know, they're the ones that, as I say, that are playing these matches and they really enjoy it. They can see that the league matches are so, you know, they're played in the depths of the winter, but they're so close, they're so exciting. Mm. There's very little between the teams in a general sense. And can you imagine when you transfer that over into the better weather and the longer evenings? I think we'll have a great championship ahead.
I think that's an underrated part of this, that for 8, 9, 10, 12 weeks of the summertime, there's going to be big games in Tullamore, in Athlone, in Navan, in Newbridge, like in non-urban areas. There's going to be a transfer of people coming and going, spending money and having parties, and like just generally the whole country could do with that.
Yeah, well, I look at, as you say, like we don't have all the answers. But you have to have an opinion, and I think I would agree with all of that. So you'd imagine, you know, that's it, and you know, that's not there at the minute. It's a huge opportunity, and it's a huge opportunity to balance out a lot of things. Maybe won't be as many, and you can still use Croke Park. You know, there might be an opportunity there to you know, maybe play not double header in Croke Park as well, because players love the opportunity to get there, and it's very hard for players in the lower divisions. Look, there's loads of things you can look at in the overall. There would be a responsibility, I'm sure, towards you know, people that corporate ticket people in Croke Park as well that you know would have bought tickets on a promise of so many matches being there. So that all has to be considered. So like, it's not a simple thing to fix, but there are some, to me there are positives far outweigh the possible negatives. There are a few, as I say, negatives or maybe tweaks that might be needed down the road. But I think generally there's people feel it's the right thing right across the country, and it's then to get to 60%. But I don't think there's any support for Proposal A for teams to go out into other provinces. So it's this or stay as we are. And I think it would be a very backward step to stay as we are with all the problems that we know we've had over the years.
Do you know what, Michael? I think people listening to you this morning would have gained a good bit of hope that your delegates going to Congress are actually unanimously in favour of this, because I think you kind of touched on it yourself there, that the GAA can be a conservative enough organisation, and there is this feeling out there that the people who go to Congress are the very living proof of that, almost, that they are conservative. But actually, from what you're saying, there was good discussion that happened in Offaly, good constructive debate that happened, and you've come to the conclusion. And I think that'll give people a lot of hope that all the other county boards around Ireland are doing a similar thing.
Yeah, well, I tell you, I qualify, in a general sense, it's not conservative. It's just that there is, you know, you don't know what way things are going to go. So you're taking a little bit of a shot into the unknown. But I think, look, the evidence is there. And I say, if somebody came out and just said, look, we've looked at this under these headings, and this is what we think, and it will work or should work, I think that would give great hope. But the other thing just about our delegates, you know, I see them in there last night. It was the first, actually, physical meeting since March 2019. And, you know, it's another thing, a huge challenge facing the association is the work that volunteers are doing on the ground. You know, we actually at the minute have no full-time staff in Offaly. Our operations manager retired some months ago and we haven't replaced him yet. And, you know, some counties have a huge amount. I've talked about this before in terms of equality of funding, etc. But, you know, the time and effort even for club, like the amount of matches, and this split season has caused, I suppose, a huge... We also had all of last year's championships. Well, not all of them, but we had to finish our senior hurling championship. We had all our underage competitions. And we have finished all of them now, and we're getting to knockout stages in all of this year's. But we're running right up to the third week in November. And the work rate on these people, and you know, there can be criticism. It actually annoys me intensely when I hear people talking about these fogies and the GAA, et cetera, and I'm one of those myself now. But the work that they put in on the ground on a day-to-day basis, and the pressure that they're under, and the responsibility of even chairing a club now, and or secretary of a club, the work rate is absolutely... massive. And I have nothing but the highest regard for all of these people, but it is going to be a challenge into the future. Like you don't see too many people maybe under 40 years of age or 50 years of age maybe even at even club meetings or county meetings anymore. And it's going to take a lot of thinking as well, and soul searching, I think, in terms of, you know, recruiting new people. And I see how hard it is to fill any role with the right people. And there's a lot of roles that you need to fill to be able to operate properly and successfully. It's nothing to do with today's debate, but it's a huge challenge.
I think it feeds into it, Michael, to be honest. I think that...
Everything feeds it.
Do you know, I do. I think if everybody agrees at the start, this is our plan now for the next 3 years, it'll be a much more vibrant place. It'll be, I think, easier to get people to come because, you know... I definitely, talking to players over the last 10 years from counties that weren't the three or four counties who believed they could win in All-Ireland, there was this sense of what's the point? And it kind of feeds into a lot of people's decision. They're going to just volunteer for the club. They're not going to go on to be a delegate at county board because ultimately they're in a second or third tier organisation that isn't actually quite respected centrally the way it should be. But I believe that this is an opportunity for every county to get the respect it deserves, to have full home grounds for matches that are meaningful at the end of a training period that everybody's been training for the same amount of time. I don't know, it just feels like we're ready for an explosion here, and for whatever reason there's a blockage.
Yeah, no, there's a great opportunity to breathe new life, and I agree with you, because like it does need that, and you need that all the time in terms of driving the team forward. And and look, I think maybe, you know, I suppose, you know, county boards are, as you said, they're so busy as well, lads. And like, you can't underestimate this. Like, there's 10 motions on the on, and we've looked at them in detail. We've discussed them at management level in terms of what way we're going to. We had a brief discussion on them last night at county. Like, some of them are minor enough in comparison to this one, but But there's some interesting ones in there as well. And to take the time and to go through them and to tease them out and analyse them and to discuss them and to reach a consensus, that all takes, and to go and talk to a lot of online meetings as well over the last 18 months. And there's so much happening on a day-to-day basis. There's matches coming at you every night in clubs and everything else. And this is what happens, that things like this don't maybe get the attention that they should get. And then they're maybe not passed, or they are, whatever, or maybe wrong decisions are made.
Yeah.
For like those little ones we would have, like the giant captains, like, what difference does it make that just two lads go up and accept a cup? And it just happens and slips through, maybe because people aren't thinking. And that's a very minor issue. But so I just think, stand back and say, go through a process, talk to your players, really engage them, talk to your management, talk to your delegates. It takes a few days, and explain because I'd say a lot of people out there, even involved in clubs all over the country, don't fully understand, what's actually happening with this.
No, I think that's fair enough. So just my last point on this is you actually haven't seen official documentation around the finances yet. That hasn't been communicated with you guys, and presumably it hasn't been communicated with the provincial council either, because they would have passed it on to you to say, look, this is what the financial projections for plan A look like, this is what they look like for plan B, and this is the status quo.
Correct.
And you want those?
Yeah, I think it's very important. I think it's very important to give that. I think if coming from your provincial councils down to give that, I think that would certainly add a lot of weight to the decision making that's going to happen at Special Congress.
Okay, good stuff, Michael. Thanks a million for taking the time to join us this morning. I think it's important to get the viewpoint of people who have a meaningful voice and who are actually going to be there putting their hands up or pressing the button. Hopefully, it's a yes for Plan B, but we'll see. Thanks a million.
Okay, lads. Cheers. Good talk to you.
Michael Dignan there. Kenny, you're obviously...
That's really interesting. Last couple of weeks, had a couple of people on. Very interesting to listen to there. Connor in particular for me. I know you're talking about, let's crunch the numbers, let's see exact figures. But sometimes I think you have to take a step back. Connor was talking about just the basic arithmetic here in terms of volume of games. 3 times more games. We know how much support there is for Gaelic football amongst the... the length and breadth of the country. People will turn out, particularly more competitive games. And he wasn't even touching upon the commercial side, as you mentioned there, was he, in terms of sponsorship and TV rights in particular. I think everybody can appreciate that potentially that could snowball off the back of like more competitive football. But for me, like, I'd really value the opinion of the players themselves, the GPA over here. Now, you could flip this over to England and start talking about other players over in England, etc., etc. And to be honest with you, I'll take with a pinch of salt if we're talking about the Premiership over in England, because I throw back the argument to you that, look, players in England, for me, self-interest massive. I really wouldn't trust to a large extent what players are saying. We saw that European breakaway, Super League, World Cup every 2 years, high profile players coming out. Yeah, I support that, totally acting in their own kind of self-interest, sponsorship deals, more profile for themselves, etc., etc., etc. With the players over here, I always get a sense of it's a case if they park their own individual motivation, what's good for them. It's about kind of club, kind of county and the game as a whole. I genuinely feel as if that's what's kind of driving the players when they come out and they support this. So that's a good thing for me. That's why I think players and managers over here, more so than any other sport, any certainly professional sport, I kind of value what the players say. I think it's more important than generally speaking. And just the last thing I'd say, the gentleman you had on here last week, was it Sean Kelly, the older gentleman? I thought he made a great point when he was speaking. And he said about players in the smaller counties who are becoming disillusioned with the game. You spoke about it there, Ger, in terms of the amount they invest with their county, in terms of training, the commitment which they make, the sacrifices which they make, the turn up, and potentially have all that ended over the course of 80 minutes football and having to go repeat the process again, and to the point where they're actually becoming disillusioned and walking away from the game, becoming disillusioned. That absolutely hit me like a hammer last year, because I think those players should be valued just as much as the more higher profile players playing for the bigger counties around the county. So that was absolutely key for me. When I heard that last week from Sean Kelly, for me, that was absolutely massive. So that's got to change. So how do you kind of change that? How do you encourage these people, keep them involved and keep them motivated? Well, this seems to me like an obvious solution. I know it's not a simplistic solution, but for me, from the outside looking in, and I'm not as heavily invested as you lads in terms of the gas scene over here, you're right. I'm actually, the more I read about it and listen to people, listen to Michael talking there, the more I get potentially excited about the prospect. It just kind of changed the direction a little bit.
I think that this is like a transformational moment for all sorts of different reasons. We'll be into the year 3 of this, and there'll be new chance for players from fans who are travelling the length and breadth of the country, who are injecting money into local economies. They're absolutely desperate for it. Like, jersey sales will increase. The point you make about players, right? So 10 years we've been talking about Longford. Dennis Connerton, the Longford manager at the time, went and said in the paper he tried 60 players to try and fill his squad, and he couldn't fill a squad for Longford because they were all going, why would I? I think the draw had already been made, and I think they had Dublin in the first round. Might have been one of those seasons where the draw gets made in November. A big hoo-ha is made about this draw, and we all know it's completely meaningless because there's three games ultimately that are going to decide the destination of the championship, and he couldn't get players to come. And everybody says that we don't know, and there's an interesting piece by Martin Brownie today, and it's certainly there is a massive imbalance where Longford are in the same championship as Dublin in the first place, right? But if Longford had all their best players playing week in, week out in Division 3, there's a chance they could win Division 3, but their best players won't show up if they know that in summer the one game that's going to be on TV will then be beaten 40 points by Dublin, because why would you go... why would you volunteer for that?
So the indirectly you're saying that pool of players is actually going to get stronger around the country. You're going to keep those stronger players. Yeah, the whole product then is going to become stronger. It's going to become more competitive. It's going to become more attractive, potentially people like investors.
The grounds will improve because they'll have to. Because there'll actually be more people coming through. The toilets will have to be clean. There'll have to be a lick of paint.
Yeah. People want to come. It's not as if we're talking League of Ireland football here. Where do we get these people out to go and watch? It's almost like a desperation thing. Where can we get them to come and watch? To force them, not force them, but to win them over, to make the argument. You feel with the GAA, the football, the hurling, it's there already.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
They're waiting to be won over.
Yeah, that connection is there. They want it, just almost looking for that, just that small little push, and this could be it.
Instead, we're saying, no, there's no point in you coming because your team's going to get hockeyed.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely hockeyed. And actually, there's no point in you investing in your ground because you're never going to get any games that matter. There'll be a couple of league games, and sure, there's only going to be 1,500 of those. It's like, well, actually, what if we made the league the championship and played it in summertime when the weather was good?
Yeah.
Your best players will be playing.
Yeah.
Every club will be represented.
And I love the point you made there, Jared, about the big games being dotted around towns, the length and breadth of Ireland. That's absolutely fantastic. Cavalcades of cars coming into those small towns, parking up, spending their money. Yes, on a load of different levels. Not just, you can get focused sometimes on the economical, financial side, but just from a social point of view. A lot of these towns struggling, small businesses, the high street,
bypassing
big motorways, bypassing these small towns now, forgotten about. Absolutely phenomenal that in terms of the effect it could have.
And we got a tiny glimpse of that in 18 and 19 with the Super 8s, but the problem was it was only a fraction of the country. Clonus was amazing. That first year of the Super 8s. Castlebar for that Mayo Donegal game, by all accounts, was absolutely sensational. I know for a fact that Killarney for that Kerry Mayo game was amazing, but instead everybody's involved in this all of a sudden. Everybody gets a chance to kind of feel what it's like to have these unique fixtures that mean something in your own backyard. But actually the streets are thronged because it's July, or because it's May or June rather than it being February, and you're actually deciding, God, there's a blizzard outside, will I go to watch my team in the National League,
or will I sit at home watching on TV?
Yeah,
I think that, that's why we've been so agitated about this whole thing. And no one was talking about it until the GPA came out last week. We were literally the only ones, not the only ones, but the vast majority of people hadn't been talking about it. And now it's starting to, there's a little bit in the papers every day, but it's fundamentally going to alter the sporting landscape if they go for it. And if they don't go for it, I can see a lot of people saying...
It's a bit like playing out from the back, the Stephen Kenny revolution, risk and reward.
You got to stick with the... Yeah. You got to show some signs of progression.
Yeah, they're standing still, they're going backwards, as they say. But yeah, it is a small element of risk there. But for me, it's absolutely minimal. And I just think potentially this thing could take off, like you're saying, the possibilities here. You get that bit of a tinge, don't you, thinking potentially where it could go. So... yeah, why not? Let's take a leap of faith.
I agree. 8:44 this morning. OTB AM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors. A very special episode of the Football Pod is now live. Dublin GAA star and former international rugby star Hannah Tyrrell joined Andy, Paddy and Tommy. She spoke about her struggles with mental health, barriers for women in sport, why she stopped playing rugby and much more as well. If you've been listening to the Football Pod, it's very strong stuff. If you've not heard it, do yourself a favour and check it out. As ever, it's live on the OTB Sports app for 24 hours first. That's the best place to find it. And we'll play out with a preview of that chat a little bit later on this morning. A quick run through the sports pages this morning. We have many candidates for Tab of the Morning to you. Everybody was in good form last night. It turns out the win brings creativity. So we'll start with otbsports.com. And it's Robinson Hattrick helps Ireland put Qatar to the sword at the Aviva. We've got player ratings. Andy McEntee survived last night. Fairly straightforward survival for him in the end. And Hungary fans ended up clashing with the police, and there was arrest made for that as well. Front page of the Examiner this morning is Singing the Blues in our beautiful jersey. Beautiful. It looks long sleeve because obviously Colin Robinson's wearing the Under Armour as well. Robinson fires hat-trick as Ireland let loose on Qatar. The Daily Mail, Rhapsody in Blue. Kenny's Ireland on a roll, but manager refuses to get carried away. They also have the Andy McEntee story surviving. The front of the Irish Times sports section, Robinson leads the rout as Ireland impress again. Our Callum is a goal machine and Stephen Kenny is beaming, is the headline on that. So the back page of the Guardian is John Stones celebrating after his equaliser. Sticks and stones, England scrape draw, but trouble mars game. Obviously they're qualified anyway, so it doesn't really matter. The Indo, 10 million jackpot up for grabs in championship revamp. It's 10 million extra money that might be generated by Plan B, which is the other side of this. We can get caught up in the economics of it, but the economics make sense apart from all of the other social aspects of it. Kenny looks to the future after Robinson runs riot is the headline on that. I'm going to do these ones. Blue Thunder is the back page headline on the Star. I just want to read you a little bit of Eamon Dunphy. He was having a good night last night. This is one of the great nights in Irish soccer history. It's a very long time since we've had an evening like that, and it shows the natural talent that we have and what you can do if you play without fear. That's what everyone's doing now. We played modern football, a passing game. We looked like Barcelona at times, or Spain, or Italy. We passed the ball around and the movement was good and the crowd loved it. It was brilliant to watch. That was a fabulous performance. It was a superb win and one that answered all the questions about Stephen Kenny. He was loving it. He was feeling it last night.
Do you know what, Jared? Like, I mean,
I'd like to have been beside Dunphy when he was feeling it like this, because that is as effusive as I've ever seen.
And what's really interesting,
I've been reading him 35 years, roughly, since I was about 10.
What's interesting that people will say in response to that, and to some of what's been said in the aftermath, it's only a friendly. But actually, what's really interesting is that it is only a friendly. And like, we can't do anything to control our emotion when watching these games. And yet I think there's a lot of people who felt like Eamon Dunphy watching that game last night, and it was still only a friendly. Imagine what it would have been like if that was actually a meaningful qualifier. Like, people aren't stupid enough to get carried away with a friendly, but yet that's kind of happening because the quality of fare in a lot of people's minds was that good over the course of the last couple of games. So I think in a way, the fact that it was just a friendly almost kind of enhances the national mood around the team. I'm not saying it proves anything with the direction the team is going, but the mood around the team and the support that the team is going to get. The atmosphere, when the national anthem comes before that Portugal game,
it's going to be good.
That is going to be incredible.
That game's going to sell out. It's going to be 50,000. What do you think of that, Joe Duffy? That's the headline of Mark McCadden's piece. Picture of Callum Robinson. The subheader almost got it right here in the Herald. Here's to you, Mr. Robinson. But the best variation of that one is, here's to you, Kisses Robinson. That's good. You're not yeah, even Kenny. You're getting sucked into it now, Kenny. It's like, yeah, I agree. That is good. Hat-trick hero is buzzing. Was there another one in there? Treble rouser. It's shake and vax for Robbo as he thrills fans.
You've saved the best of last, though.
Shake and vax. Robinson Blueso. Blueprint for the future is starting to take shape. This is the Mirror, to give them the credit. Blueprint for the future is starting to take shape as Kenny's men win again and Callum hits treble to sink the World Cup hosts. Treble rouser, it's shake and vax for Robbo, is pretty good, right? It's like shake, S-H-E-I-K-H, just so you get it. Qatar and the vax, because the vaccine, shake and vax.
I think most people got the second.
I'm not sure.
I can't explain that one.
It was an ad. He doesn't even know the shake and vax ad existed.
Shake and vax. Put the freshness back. Do the shake and back and put. No?
Ah, come on.
This is a common theme here every morning, Kenny, where I set into the juvenile corner while
fresh.
People get wistful about the 1980s.
The room does classic. Too.
Classic.
Every time you vacuum, remember what to do.
Tune into rolling back the ears when RT is
reeling in the ears.
You'll pick up a ring in the ears.
I can't believe you don't know that. That's a classic, important cultural moment in our lives.
Maybe I do. I didn't confirm whether I do or not.
Okay, well, look, the papers are full of effusive praise this morning. It's very rare that we get to do this, that everybody's kind of...
Yeah, I've no problem with that. Yeah, let's jump on board. In terms of, I think Owen's right, just in terms of that kind of, let's not try and box it off, that the kind of outpouring of emotion a little bit. And there's been talk sometimes, isn't there, Jerry, about a little bit of a disconnect maybe between the supporters. And that's been the case. I know people, friends of mine, who just kind of stopped going to football and...
the Aviva for quite some time. So that is important. That connection's always been special. Probably hasn't been as strong as been the case previously. So yeah, hopefully we'll see that. We'll see the fans and the players come together. I think you're right, that Portugal game for me. Now, last night, I wouldn't be getting too carried away with that atmosphere inside the stadium. Yeah, the flashing lights and the whole shebang, whatever. But that stadium was half full last night. And I don't like looking around the stadium and seeing half empty stadiums. So for me, full house against Portugal, I agree with you. I think that will be the case. I think that's going to be important because I think that's the players are going to feed off that in the game against Portugal. We're actually going to need them that night because we're not going to have it all our own way against Portugal. We're going to have those moments, periods of the game where, you know, we're going to get penned in, you know what I mean, and we're going to need to be lifted almost by the home crowd.
Yeah, and look, you really hope it works out for them. The other side of that is if it doesn't work out for them, you know, getting beaten by a team as good as Portugal and how bad the defeat is, it's the recovery from that again. So it's an important window in some respects.
Performance for me, let's not get carried away, you know, win. Oh, you know, we're there. Oh, loss. Let's look at the performances. Kid always is. Any kind of sport. I'd like to think most managers, coaches will say that. You know, concentrate on the performance. Like the result, take care of itself. Generally, that's the case. People talk about never quite understood. I always got a bit nervous actually when I heard a manager address him say, "Look, lads, performance today. Forget about it. It's all about the result." That never made sense to me. You know, that made me a little bit fearful, actually, but anxious. Oh, what we saying? What about that work we did on the training business? Yeah. Like, didn't matter. You know what I mean? You trust your work. You trust the body of work that you're doing on the training pitch and in the international case when you come together as a group and you try and roll it out as best you can when the games come along. You need to have confidence in that kind of your tactical setup. You just sense as if there's a little confidence growing there, that kind of cohesion's kind of coming together on a lot of different levels. So hopefully we'll continue that upward trajectory, because I think we have to be competitive and to qualify for those major tournaments coming forward. I think we need those improvements still need to come, so hopefully we're on that kind of upward trend.
Okay, 8:52, let's turn our attention to the Premier League and some quick questions about what we think is going to happen over the next while. So
Premier League, what?
I need you to get your crystal ball out, Kenny.
Rewind. Let's rewind. What are we talking about? England, Premier, what? Man United, man. Yeah, I'm with you now.
So, relegation, right? I want you to...
I'm literally... It seems as if it's like 6 months ago since we last covered a Premier League game. Mm. It's funny, isn't it? That international break and maybe a little bit kind of emotion where we are with the team and the soul kind of consuming, isn't it?
You should do it previously on the Premier League.
It's difficult to come out of it. It's difficult to come out of it and park it. And so, right, let's get back on to Premiership duty.
You know, I hope that that's a good thing in the long run if they can continue in the direction they're going and they've turned things around. Then I think that the fact that it matters so much now, because there was definitely international breaks. It was creeping in. Like, you'd be on your phone for most of the match, flicking. Oh, we've got another corner. They've got another corner.
Like, people weren't getting excited, Joe. Were they? Like, talking. Remember the games coming up? You'd be talking about a buzz. Tickets were, but the whole shebang, be buzz. That bit of buzz around the games, I'm sure. You know, I'm sure they remember that. That hasn't been the case, like, you know what I mean? Like I said, for some time.
And maybe Kenny's critics have done a bit of a favour in kind of getting the crowd behind them. Like, they feel a bit of ownership over him. They feel a bit of ownership of the team. And the team, if they can come through that, and the signs are relatively positive at the moment, they're definitely not through it. I don't think it's over yet.
It's more about the Kenny. For the Kenny fans, a bit of Kenny fans, same with any manager, you know what I mean, to have a supporters.
It feels like
it's
the,
about
the
that,
crowd.
It's about that group and maybe not naturally gravitate towards Stephen and the staff and get behind them or potentially bringing those people all on board. Not because I'm a Stephen Kenny fan, but do you know what, forget about the manager, I actually enjoy what I'm seeing on the pitch. The football,
like,
that we're producing,
there's enough excitement in the players, like in the performances that they're putting out there, and even the backstory of some of them, we're falling in love with this team, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, the young players as well, even like Nathan Collins. I checked it last night kind of working on the game. I played with his dad, Dave,
right.
Collins. I played schoolboy football in Dublin with him. Dave played for Cherry Orchard. He went to England when he was young, he signed for Liverpool, had his career and kind of came back. So again, seeing his young fella on the pitch last night, actually when the game was over, I saw Nathan go over and try to celebrate to an extent as best you can with some family in the stand. And his dad was there to recognise me and Pat Fenlon. We're looking down and we could see him down there, and he's obviously very emotionally effective, his dad. So that was a lovely touch, you know what I mean? So it's things like that, you know, you kind of recognise, you feel almost not a part of it, like, you know what I mean?
You are a part of it, you're captain this team.
No, but you have a distance, yeah. Like, you know, this was the beauty of Irish international football for me. You felt as if you had a relationship with people from a distance. You knew him. Oh yeah, you know, his ma used to, yeah, that's his brother who lives down the road. That's a good friend of his. You know what I mean? There's a close personal, relationship, but it always felt as if the team was closer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In terms of that kind of bond between supporters and players for that reason. So little things like that, like last night for me, kind of, you know, makes it more special.
We did a piece a couple of weeks ago about the walking tour that starts in Croke Park and finishes in Dalymount. I don't know if you've ever been on it, but they stop off along the way, I think, at one of your gaffes when you were a kid. And it's kind of that conversation about...
One of me gaffes. We weren't like big property investors, you know what I mean? My mum, me dad, we didn't have 80 properties around Dublin. We used to just flip from one to the other.
Well, I don't know where you live, so I wasn't sure if you'd moved or not.
You used to flip a little bit. That would have been getting into the old carpo house.
And the amount of footballers who live between or who grew up in that area, like, I can see why it feels like it's a community thing. You know, you kind of come from an area which was a hotbed of Irish football. It hasn't really been talked about like that.
Yeah, I never really thought of it that way, to be honest, but you're probably right. You throw a blanket around maybe that part of the Dublin, but it's bigger than that really, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's bigger. It's kind of, it's across the whole island, isn't it? The representation which we have, Cork players in
now
particular,
it is,
Kerry, and all over. Now you're talking about exactly players now who are not necessarily born in the country. Teodosi Ogbonna, he's a very interesting story there in terms of his family coming and settling in Ireland. That was a very nice read the article about him. Obviously kind of grew up and very close to the community down in Cork for obvious reasons. That's where he grew up, that's all he's known. But his dad, he was saying, had the option of actually moving the family from Nigeria to Ireland or Florida in the United States, and he made the choice to go to Ireland. And the reason was he worked with a number of Irish people in his work and had a really kind of positive experience with them, and that made his mind up for him. Well, this is the environment where I want my family, my child to grow up in. So that was a kind of really nice touch and a little backstory there that you're talking about. I think people feed off that a little bit in terms of making that connection with the squad as well, Jerry. Just little small things like that make a big difference.
It all adds up and it all matters and it all makes the team really interesting at the moment. And
I can't believe those Munster lads are too happy wearing that Leinster jersey. Is there going to be an issue? It's going to be an issue with that.
Maybe it can unite us
going forward.
It's going to bring us all together.
It's got to be Ulster red, maybe. It's got Munster red. Connacht. Is that blue? Is that blue? Connacht blue?
Well, Connacht's green.
Green is the tradition. Oh, right.
Well, maybe that's it. Like, once we put on the Ulster colours, the IFA will just disband right now and say, take all our players. You can have them.
And we've opened a can of worms. Let's get back to the Premier League can of worms. Who's going to get relegated, Kenny? Give me
Come on. Are we struggling for time?
No, we're not.
You need a filler. Is that what it is?
Not at all. It's the opposite. People are like...
Who's what? Name them.
Newcastle
Name
United.
Check them. Who's tweeted in this morning? I'm desperately needed to talk about the bottom three in the Premiership. We're going to get relegated, Jer, please.
Well, okay. Well, then we'll skip the relegation.
Kenny down on that.
Let's skip the relegation.
None, obviously, from what you're saying.
Are Newcastle going to get relegated?
I don't, but that's dependent, Jared, isn't it? Because I talk about Steve Bruce being out the door in a couple of weeks
or an hour.
So that's going to be a huge factor. You know, he goes out and Antonio Conte comes in the next couple of weeks. I mean, I think that's going to be a factor in terms of whether Newcastle are going to stay up or not. You know, whether 100-200 million becomes available in the January transfer window, I think it's going to be significant, relevant in terms of whether Newcastle stay up.
They can spend 190 apparently.
Just trying to make a point to you.
I get the point you're making, but it's almost bang on in terms of the amount of money they might spend. They've got to go crazy in the transfer window to make sure they don't get relegated. But if you go too crazy,
yeah, exactly. No, I think that's dangerous. I think that's a dangerous thing. I think ideally, if you're looking at it, should you change the manager? I'm not saying you shouldn't change the manager, to be honest with you. There's an argument there for terms of stabilisation, keep the manager in place. He understands the players were there, he's worked with them, and maybe giving him responsibility to add to that in the transfer window. Not a huge sum of money, but maybe two or three players in key areas of the pitch in that transfer window. Maybe that's a better argument in terms of them staying up this year rather than making that Brute, out you go. There's 10 million, off you go.
Give him Antonio 10 million Conte. Bonus for keeping the team in the Premier League. Give him 100 million to spend and go, just keep us in the Premier League. That's all you have to do. And at the end of the summer, you can go off and we'll get Brendan
I think there's an argument for that. That may well be the case. We'll wait and see.
Yeah, I think they're going to shoot him though, because that's when new business comes in and goes, this is ours. We're going to take it. We want to play with these things. I've got new toys. So I'd be interested.
Not too
to see
many
what
though. Who'd you put in there then? If you're a Newcastle supporter at the moment, who?
Rodgers is favourite.
Brendan Rodgers.
Yeah.
Well, he's not going to jump. He's not going to jump from Leicester at the moment. Maybe end of the season, but he's not foolish enough. Brendan Rodgers for me is someone who very much in terms of image, how his perception, how he's viewed in that respect. For him to jump, which what he'd have to do, he'd have to fight his way out of Leicester City. He'd have to go and strike Gardner Jew. That's very messy. Not too many top managers like to go down that particular route. So I can't see anybody in a job.
I think you're right about that. But the only thing about Brendan Rodgers is how many jobs are there going to be that he is in the reckoning for? So he's had the Liverpool job, he's not getting that again. And because he's had the Liverpool job, he's not getting the Man United job. After that, how is he going to? He might get the Chelsea job at some point.
I agree with you. I get a sense, don't know Brendan Rodgers too well, but I get a feeling looking at Brendan Rodgers, somebody really kind of ambitious and motivated and wants to operate at a higher level than Leicester, and feels as if he's good enough. And I think you're right, his options will be limited in that respect. I even think potentially he can go abroad, but in terms of what's available within the Premiership, I think you're right. Arsenal, Chelsea, you could make an argument.
Totally Arsenal.
But in terms of where Leicester are in a good place at the moment, you know what I mean? So he really feels, if you're going to make that jump up.
Can I just ask? Though, so if we go through those, right, so the Chelsea job, unfortunately Tuchel has done a great job. If you're like advising Rodgers at the moment, Tuchel's done a great job. He ain't going anywhere for at least 18 months. He's probably got 18 months of a window.
Change quickly though, you know,
Chelsea can change.
I think that's an option.
Rodgers' stock could also be damaged as well in that time, and I mean they haven't started the season well. Just put it to you,
let me get to the other. Spurs, are you gonna will you go Daniel Levy? No thanks. For Brendan Rodgers, I want to sign this player. Levy, like, no. I want to sell this player. No, you can't, because I like him. Not gonna be a great fit.
Yeah.
Arsenal, yeah, okay, fair enough. He could definitely get the Arsenal job, but maybe Arteta's turned that round. Which kind of makes Newcastle all of a sudden like...
Stand alone, though. Forget about the rule book when it comes. This is unprecedented, really, is in terms of what's going to happen with Newcastle. People are like, well, Newcastle step down, look where they are. Leicester in a very good place, but the potential there to step into that football club.
And that's
absolutely,
why
you know what I mean?
You have to be thinking
about the amount of investment
you?
That's going to be behind. That must be attractive for any kind of manager of any stature. So I think you're right. I think Rodgers will be looking at that. And if he's got an inclination of phone call from somebody, an agent, look, are you interested in this job? I think the answer would be, yes, I'm interested. But we need to park this till the end of the season. Yeah, you can have me, but we need to do this at the start of the season.
And if they say it's now or never, buddy,
I don't think you will.
Okay.
Unless Leicester City were prepared to accommodate him and say, well, absolutely, Brendan, we're allowed to walk out the football
50
club.
Million quid.
That type of, yeah, potentially. Potentially. And Brendan's going, I don't really want to go, you know, but, you know, I've spoken to the chairman. He's accepted the 50 million. You know, I don't understand in the Leicester. If they want me to move on, I'll do the decent thing.
The best case scenario for Rodgers here is to kind of see how things play out over the next little while. And in around March or April, announce that he's leaving Leicester for Newcastle United, knowing that he's going to be managing a team in the Premier League with a big kitty in the summer, rather than going there now and being like, oh crap, this playing group is not good enough to stay in the Premier League.
Yeah.
Can I just put to you, second favourite, it's Frank Lampard.
Yeah, I wouldn't rule him out. I don't think it's helped. Obviously, things ended very quickly for him at Chelsea. But I had a bit of sympathy for him, to be honest. I personally would have stuck with him for a longer period of time. Well, I like Lampard, to be honest with you. Always struck me as somebody like very astute, intelligent. I'm talking about football intelligence here, more so than anything else. So I actually value him quite highly, and I think he'll actually will come back into the game. I'm not too sure. If I was looking at somebody of that ilk, for me, it's probably Gerrard gets the nod over Lampard. Now Lampard's out of a job at the moment, but I was looking at those two players at the moment. Me, from Gerrard's the one I'd lean towards with those particular two type of players, if that's what you're after. But I just think of, you know, the amount of investment they're going to put into that football club, you would just feel as if
Gerrard not too inexperienced for.
But this is what I'm saying. You would imagine the chit chat, the advice that they're getting, the owners of that football club, if they have owners, it's a personal, you know, wealth fund. It's not actual links to the, as we know. But whoever those people are, Amanda Staveley or whoever it is who's up front, you would have thought the voice they're getting, we need someone of real experience, stature here, somebody we can trust, you know, won't get knocked sideways in terms of the amount of work that needs to be done here.
Yeah.
So yeah, that lends itself more to a different a different type of manager. But yeah, I find it difficult at the moment to see, you know, Conte's out of a job, and I'm a huge fan of Conte, but I'm not too sure. I think they might well have to park it till the end of the season. Yeah. But I think
Poch could get sacked by PSG before then, or something like crazy things are going to happen.
No, things can change very quickly. We know what it's like, manager turnover, that short period of time. But I think you're right with Rodgers, and I think he's very astute, Brendan Rodgers. I think he's going to have a difficult season at Leicester. I thought that before the season started. I thought it was a great window of opportunity for them the past two seasons.
Yeah, and then
in terms of that jump at the Champions League, and they came up short. They kind of blew it, to be honest with you, last couple of months of the season. This is going to be more difficult for them. So I think maybe his standard will have dropped a little bit by the end of the, this year. Not as easy for him to make that bounce, one of those top clubs that we're talking about. So maybe Newcastle might be the next best vehicle for him to go and build something and build a team that can actually challenge for Champions League football. That might be the better option, a funny way for him. If he wants to, I want to manage in the Champions League consistently, Newcastle may be the better option for him rather than, fingers crossed, waiting for that potential job at Chelsea to come along over the next couple of years.
Okay, very quickly, rate these teams' survival chances out of 10. Oh, are they going to survive?
Talk with a bomb.
Seven games gone. So Norwich City, survival chances out of 10. Presumably it's 1 out of 10, 2 out of 10?
Minimal.
0? Okay.
1.
Newcastle.
Never.
Newcastle.
Yeah, I'd say 4.
Ooh,
still think the forwards were the same argument lastly. Just feels if they can get their forward Callum Wilson on the pitch, Alan saying same Maximin Almiron, those type of players, just feels if they've got enough goals in them to get themselves out of trouble.
4 out of 10 means you don't think they're going to survive. So you do you think they will survive.
Oh, you didn't stipulate that. You just asked for max out of 10.
Rate their team's survival chances out of 10. 10 out of 10 means they're going to survive.
More lucky than
it's a bad formula. It's a bad formula you've got there.
Well, surely
they're definitely going to go down. What about if I could put 3 and not? They give 3 teams not. That means then 1 doesn't go down. Is that the argument?
No,
you don't understand what you're saying.
Okay.
Wouldn't you just leave it till they're going to go down or not, rather than marking system of 1 to 10? You're just confused, just muddying the waters.
Easier for us to sell on social. What? Okay, so Norwich are going to go down. Who else is going to go down? Burnley, Southampton, Leeds, Watford, Palace. Anybody else getting dragged in? Villa, Brentford, Brighton. They're not going to get dragged in.
No, I think what's happened at Villa is actually extraordinary, to be honest with you. One of the sides are really... Oh, your team actually wasn't saying that for that reason. No, really exciting team they're putting together up there. So no, I don't think they'll have any worries whatsoever. Yeah, same old faces, kind of half a dozen that you mentioned there. But like I said, I think it is dependent what happens between now and the end of the season, transfer window, etc. But yeah, it will be those teams. No, that doesn't help you. That's not the punch you were looking for.
Okay, let's try this one again.
Who's going to win the Premiership?
No, okay,
the original one.
We're going to look at, because the transfer window is about to, the speculation certainly is going to ramp up immediately. It already has. But there's some of the big transfers that have already been made. Give us... marks out of 10 for these, right?
Oh,
Grealish to City.
Yeah, I'll give him a 7. I'll give him a 3 at the weekend, but I blame the manager for that, because he made that ludicrous decision again to throw him in as that false number 9. I just don't understand it. I really don't. He looked uncomfortable in the position in terms of his, you know, positional sense, areas to pick up. He was struggling to get into the game. He was kind of wandering around the pitch for me, Grealish. You play him left with 3s, he has done predominantly. You find a deeper midfield position for him. So I don't think he was actually helped the previous game against Liverpool. I thought his manager actually hung him out a little bit in the game against Liverpool. But I'm a huge fan of him, I'd have to say that.
Go on.
What I was going to say, he needs to pick up the phone to his former Republic of Ireland teammate Callum Robinson and say, listen, Callum, how have you managed to adapt from a wide player to a goal scoring central player?
But I suppose that'd be my point. He has to adapt to playing that position. But why? He's got players where Guardiola best suited to that position.
Is Guardiola playing a long game with somebody like that and saying, this is what this player... So the Ajax way was Bergkamp played right back for 3 or 4 games to teach him what the right back was thinking and what the movement was like. So the next time he played, he had a deeper understanding of it.
But that's like schoolboy academy football. There's a certain argument to that in terms of understanding certain positions, your player development at a young age. But this is like professional football that we're talking about.
No, but they get better. They get deeper understanding of what they're trying to do.
It takes time. But yeah, but could cost you. Manchester City could have won that game. Played Grealish off the left, play Foden off the right. Foden can impact the game from anywhere, and play Jesus down the middle of the pitch for me, give him a stronger chance of winning that game against him. They could have won that game.
I agree with you. I'm trying to get into somehow into Guardiola's season. Head to understand what he thinks. Like, why is he doing
it? I don't know what he's thinking. He's done it time and time again, particularly that false number 9 one. I don't understand that, because some players may just better suit to that position. Why not play players who are better suited to that position than others.
And in form, Jesus had just scored the winner against Chelsea the previous week.
Yeah, look at Ferran Torres during the week, League of Nations, the goals he's gone he's playing in that
Ferran Torres is amazing for Spain.
Yeah, but people say, oh, another false number nine, but I think he's more of a natural number nine in terms of the positions and the runs that he's making.
Stick him in the team.
Into the box, yeah. But he can't get onto the pitch. He's got to look at Jack Grealish kind of zombie walking around in that area of the pitch, not understanding the role, what he's expected to do.
Okay, Ronaldo to Manchester United out of 10.
7.5.
Okay. Why is he getting deducted marks?
Well, it was always going to be that quid pro quo, wasn't it? And you can see him, obviously, in terms of his
who's
qualities.
The boss?
Sorry?
Who's the boss? Is that the quid pro quo?
No, a little bit of that, to be honest with you. You can sense a little bit of that bubbling under the surface. He's not happy to be sat on that bench at any time. He's not happy to be brought off the pitch at any particular time. The best example of that for me was when we brought off against Young Boys of Bern, kind of 15 minutes ago. Probably should have been brought off at half time with the sending off they had that game. And Solskjaer literally like tripping over himself to try and explain himself, apologising as he was walking down the touchline. That's not a good look for me, like, you know what I mean? And they can't have Tim in. He's a big enough personality in the dressing room. And the likes of Pogba, Sanchez had a difficult start there. I think you're right.
He made that speech and nobody had desserts, so therefore it must be a winner-winner. No? 10 out of 10.
Winner-winner. Be careful with the sprinkling of whatever you put on your chicken and your dinner sort of thing.
Yeah.
I think it's fascinating, Manchester United, to be honest with you. It's not going to be difficult. It's going to be a difficult dressing room to manage if things start to go a little bit skew-whiff during the course of the season.
Varane to Man United out of 10?
Varane?
Yeah.
Yeah, like 8. Yeah, pretty much as expected. And that first game against Wolves just like strikes me as like a ballerina, the way he kind of moves over the ground, doesn't he? Like he moves on the top of his toes, and it's all a bit seamless. No, I think he's strengthened the team. Good signing for me.
Okay, he's a little bit injury. His injury profile is not amazing, and he's going to be out for a little while,
a couple of weeks.
So that
doesn't help.
No, it's definitely a little kind of asterisk there. Just as the season goes on, will he play 20 games? Will he play 30 games? Will he play 40 games? There's a big difference, you know.
Yeah, there is. Yeah. I think he needs to play those 40 games, like you're talking about, because there's a small soft centre that Manchester United back four when he doesn't play.
But they're back to square one now. He's out for a few weeks. They said so. I mean, it's all of a sudden.
Maguire's
out as well, or possibly. Yeah. So it's going to be very interesting to see if it's just like Groundhog Day for Manchester United.
We've got Leicester at 3 o'clock on Saturday for Manchester United, Burnley at 3 o'clock for City on Saturday, and the next one is Jadon Sancho. What do you make of Jadon Sancho's transfer to Manchester United so far?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a struggle for him. Yeah, I wouldn't give up on him. Yeah, I watched a lot of him in Germany. He was like absolutely fantastic, but would be a basic thing to say, but just like a step up in level to a certain extent, maybe even expectation. So he struggled that a little bit. He's found a tough, felt sympathy for him. We're talking about the Young Boys, the game Wan-Bissaka got sent off. That must have hurt him getting pulled straight away 35 minutes in. I looked at that. You're not talking about managers, big decisions. The mentality of the player kind of struggling, going to a new club, struggling a little bit, real frustration there. You're trying to find a little bit of form. You need minutes on the pitch. 35 minutes into that particular game, sending off, you got to whip somebody out, woof, you get the hook. You know what I mean? Mm. And I just thought, in terms of even Solskjaer, he needed to stay on the pitch just in terms of his mindset to keep him in a good place. That would have hurt. No player likes getting the fish hook 35 minutes in, regardless of the circumstances. Like, so that was very interesting to me in terms of like him getting hooked there. That wouldn't have helped him. So he's struggling. He is scratching around a little bit for form. There's no doubt about that. I mean, I like Sancho, don't get me wrong, and I think they are strengthened with him in the squad. But again, before they signed Sancho, if you'd have said to me, 85 million to spend, where are you going to spend it?
Yeah.
Centre midfield. Go big. You need a central midfielder, because at the time, well, what about right-sided midfielder? You got Greenwood there. You got Greenwood there, who can easily operate it off the right-hand side. Martial, Rashford, as we spoke about, Cavani there as well. Daniel James was still at the football club, you know, so plenty of options there. For me, it was crying out for that holding midfield. It didn't happen. They spent the money on Sancho. Are they stronger because of it? Yes, but he needs to play better than he is at the moment, clearly.
He may well be a signing for the medium term, but Solskjaer lives in every week is a referendum on him. That's the situation he finds himself in. So, I see why you would take the opportunity to buy a player of that quality, but they haven't helped him in his integration. They've picked him in the wrong position a couple of times. And
yeah, he's playing off the left predominantly, isn't he? Most of the time at Dortmund, he played right of a three. You know what I mean?
So out of 10 at the moment?
Oh, so 5.5, 6, Sancho at the moment, yeah.
All right. And Lukaku, how impressed are you by Lukaku's early signs at Chelsea? They've got Brentford on Saturday at 5:30, so all the big guns on Saturday.
Yeah, he hasn't scored a huge amount of late, but he is what he is, Lukaku. It's what it says on the tin, pretty much. You know, when you look at Lukaku, if you look at the types of goals that he scored, if you look at the types of goals that he scored for Milan over the past couple of seasons under Conte, Conte got the very best out of him, but he actually structured, actually built the team around him, even in terms of how Inter Milan played, you know, leaning towards a more counter-attacking game, because it best suited Lukaku in terms of hitting teams in the counter-attack, getting him running down the channels. But if you look at the goals that he scores predominantly, it doesn't overthink things. It's like shift, shot, shift, shot. When he gets into that position, you need that type of Robbie Fowler type finish, a little kind of bit of a dink or a little bit more of a creative edge. You don't get that too much from Lukaku, but I still like him. Absolutely, Chelsea are strengthened with him coming into the squad, and he could still make the difference, because for me they're in the shake-up, Chelsea, with Liverpool and Manchester City for that title.
Can I run one hot take by you? I mean, we're not on air or anything, so nobody's going to hear this, but Timo Werner to break out from here to the end of the season and actually go close to matching Lukaku goals-wise.
Match Lukaku.
Maybe matching Lukaku is an overstatement.
Owen loves him. Some
I love
Werner.
Don't say it. If it's an overstatement, don't say it.
Have a very respectable season, as in teens.
He's watering this down.
No, hit the teens goals-wise.
Watering can. Hold on, Owen. Keep going.
I'm going to hose it down now, your original statement. Hit the teens with goals in the Premier League this season.
Timo Werner, not to totally stink.
Yeah.
It'd actually be very good.
I've been a little bit disappointed, to be honest with you, in terms of his contribution while he's been at the football club. And to be honest with you, if you'd offered me, if somebody had said to Chelsea side of the season, give the money you paid for him, I'd have taken it.
Newcastle, come on down. Would you like a little bit of Timo Werner action? Come on.
Did you see him the last Chelsea game? I mean, way more of a goal threat than
Lukaku. Let's forget the previous 30. Let's just focus
on that. That's why it's a hot take, Kenny. I'm jumping to conclusions based on one game.
Now, look, he'll be around the squad and he'll play his fair share of the games, but his finishing was what Finishing was dreadful.
I think with Lukaku,
you've got to be more clinical than that in terms of where opportunities presented themselves. He looks as if almost he lost his confidence last year in around the kind of penalty box. So I wouldn't give up on him, don't get me wrong. And I think he's a good option to have around the squad in terms of the qualities which he has, as opposed to other forward players, obviously Lukaku in particular. But Lukaku's going to be the focal point for that attack. And when I think about players who are going to operate, going to link up him around them, I'm thinking about Mount, Pulisic, Ziyech, those type of players. I'm looking at those type of combinations that will naturally work, rather than maybe a Lukaku or a Werner, you know, combination up front.
So no is the answer to my question. That's fine, Kenny. You know,
stupid question.
Who's your number one must watch Premier League team this season so far? Who's been the most enjoyable team to watch?
Good question. Do you know what, Villa? I didn't play well last week, to be honest with you. A bit of a drop off, wasn't it?
Disappointing, because it really felt like the Man United game was a corner turned.
I've watched them a couple of games. They've been really exciting. Really, some very talented forward players now. The money again invested in the summer. Got some really strong. Watkins, obviously. Ings has come in. Traore. Some outstanding talent, solid. Talking about balance, now we're talking about babying the Ireland team early on, that kind of getting that healthy balance in the team, attacking, kind of defending. Nice little balance in that Aston Villa team. Youth as well, a lot of youth energy, legs in the team as well. So they're the ones for me. I look at them actually quite excited when I watch them play. They're a good team. They're a good watch. Good watch, Jer.
Just like the Republic of Ireland, we've come full circle. Kenny, good stuff. Keep the blue jersey.
Haven't got one. I don't know.
Keep Kenny.
Have we got a contact? Can we get one of those? How do you get one of those jerseys? Can you walk into wherever it is?
Republic of Ireland captain issues, come and get me. No, they were
operating in town.
They were limited edition. There was only 2,000 of them made, I think.
No way.
Yeah.
That was smart. That they're even hard to get.
I'd be amazed if there's not one hanging up in this studio in a week, so I'll be very disappointed. Your connection. Have you burnt all your bridges with the association?
No.
We had Johnny Courtney on the show actually talking about it.
Designed it and made it, yeah.
Since everybody
agrees. If I can get my hands on one, I'll bring it in. Don't rule me out.
Republic of Ireland captain Kenny Cunningham issues, come and get me, plea to blue jersey.
just pushing kids out of the way at the front, trying to get Callum Robinson's jersey at the next moment.
This is the transfer gossip we all needed. Kenny, good stuff. Thanks a million. One last question. Paul on YouTube wants to know, would Roy Keane be in with a shout for the Newcastle gig?
That's to you, Kenny.
I'm leaving that one hanging out.
On that note, We're going to take a quick break. OTB AM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We are talking to Nicole Turner about her silver medal in the Paralympics and the importance of volunteers next.
OTB AM.
It is 20 minutes past nine this morning here on OTB AM. We're delighted to be joined now by EBS ambassador and Paralympic silver medalist Nicole Turner, along with her childhood coach and longtime swimming volunteer Emer Matthews, following the final call for nominations for the 2021 Federation of Irish Sport Volunteers in Sport Awards, which is proudly supported by EBS. The awards will see EBS and the Federation of Irish Sport hero the work of volunteers from right around the country who go above and beyond every day to ensure that sport and physical activity takes place in Ireland. To nominate an everyday hero and to be given the chance of winning €1,000 for your local sports club, just visit volunteersinsport.ie. Nominations can be made by a club, an individual or a sporting body, and the closing date for nominations is this Sunday, October 17th. So it's really easy. Go down to volunteersinsport.ie, nominate somebody who you think deserves to win, and you could be given the chance of winning €1,000, all sponsored by EBS. Now, Nicole and Emer, good morning to you both. Nicole, how are you getting on?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. Talk to us a little bit about Emer, because this is all about volunteers and the roles that they play in sport. Why was Emer important in your career?
I suppose if it wasn't for Emer, I wouldn't have learned how to swim. So I'm 19 now. I started out with Piranha Swim Club when I was 5, so back 14 years ago. After I finished all my swimming lessons, I decided to join a club. And the local club here, Port Arlington Leisure Centre, was Piranha Swim Club. And it turned out Emer was the coach of that, but she did it voluntary. So I stayed with Emer for about 7 years, and then I moved on to a different club.
Right, so very formative years. The bit where you get good at swimming, learn not to sink, and then learn to be competitive, and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I did learn how to swim in a few swimming lessons, but Emer was the really one who did get me in the pool and show me all the skills, and I suppose that's where the seed was planted. And then there was a long journey ahead of me, but Emer set out that journey for me.
Did you start competing what age would your first meets have been?
So my first ever competition was in 2009 at the World Work Games, and this was the games, I call it, it was kind of like a dwarf Paralympics, but nowhere near as serious. It's a games held every 4 years for all dwarfs around the world, and it includes all sorts of sports: swimming, athletics, team sports, cycling, anything you can think of. And it turned out in 2009, it was actually in Belfast, so my parents just decided, you know what, let Nicole go in, see what she can do, and then just so I could compete against people my own size. And then after that, I actually came away with 8 medals.
Wow.
5 gold, 2 silver and a bronze. And 4 of the gold medals were from swimming. So I think that was when something, I guess, was thought about.
Right. Wow. Emer, that must have been a pretty special time then, when you've got this sense that this is a pretty good swimmer. And then finally the competition happens. You're like, wow, we've got a really good swimmer, it turns out.
Yeah, and she's very modest, because she also won the Margaret Scott Memorial Trophy that day for being such an impressive swimmer. And we all knew we had magic on our hands then when Nicole competed and won so well that day. Yeah, she's just, I suppose, you know, to be an athlete, a successful athlete, you need to have that drive and that hunger, and that's exactly what Nicole has.
As a volunteer teaching kids how to swim, Emer, like, you really have no clue which of these will go on to be any of the swimmers who are going to represent Ireland. Some of them might just swim for the rest of their lives as a fun, and you've kind of got to be cognizant of that at some level. It's like, you don't want to turn the people off the sport by being too aggressive, but you need to help the people who do have the chance to go on to greatness as well. How do you make that balance and just keep that tension, you know, in your own head?
I suppose in our club, we try and help them realise their potential and let the children lead the way. As in, like, they're the bosses to a certain extent. And it's all about being happy and, you know, being constructive in your criticism to children and to adults. But it has to be a happy place for children to learn to swim. And when you do see somebody that has that potential, then you just encourage them. And Nicole had that potential straight away. And I suppose you know, with clear, consistent communication always with the swimmers, and it just, they become very confident. They become competent, and then they're happy swimmers, you know?
Is that the thing that motivated you a lot around that time, Nicole? Or is it the sense of, oh my God, I've got to shed a load of medals here, I've got to keep doing this thing? What was the big thing that drove you around that period of time?
No, absolutely. Like, I think at that age as well, being a coach for Emer, like, she doesn't want to, I wouldn't have wanted, like, as Emer said, I wanted it to be fun. I didn't want, like, I was 7 years of age. I didn't really see a big serious side of swimming at that age. So I just wanted to, I wanted it to be, go to a place where I had fun, where I enjoyed it and I wanted to go. I didn't want to see it as being a chore or something I had to do work for. I wanted to go and meet new friends, spend some time with friends and just have fun in the water. And that's exactly what Emer made it for the whole 7 years I was in the club.
Do you still feel that, Nicole? Do you still feel that it's fun?
Oh, absolutely. I think if it wasn't fun, I wouldn't do it. Like, it is, looking back now, it is a very serious sport from what I did see it being, what, 10, 12 years ago. But I think now it is serious. But then, like, the likes of winning a Paralympic silver medal and getting to travel across the world, that is the fun side. So it does, the hard work does pay off. So I think if it wasn't fun, I wouldn't do it.
And from your perspective, Emer, is it possible to mould those two things, the really high level of performance with enjoying your craft?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you have to just absolutely love it and love winning. And I mean, we all know that Nicole has felt the agony of losing races too. And she's also had the thrill of winning races. And, you know, you take it as it comes. But I think she's very happy in winning and well, obviously not so happy in losing, but you learn from a loss and you learn to progress and you learn what you did wrong. And you have to love it to get up there. I mean, I think this year was probably the hardest year for all athletes, not just swimming, obviously for all sports out there. And for Nicole to go to Tokyo and get onto those blocks without her family and without her friends, you know, she's the bravest person I know. And she, you have to love it, don't you, to be able to do that. And it paid off, you know.
Yeah, it totally did. When did you start taking it totally seriously, Nicole? When did you start dreaming about Paralympic Games? And I'm kind of interested in that period where, you know, the rest of us are kind of fluting around doing everything and you're like, actually, I'm going to get up early and I'm going to do my swimming before school.
I think when I went to the World Work Games in 2009, I actually met Ellie Simmons, and the year before the games, Ellie had just won her first gold medal in Beijing. So I thought, like, what, she was small just like me. I wanted to be like her one day. But like, I was a 7-year-old. I didn't really think anything of that then. But then when I left Emer in 2014, I moved to Laois Mearnins in Port Laois, and that was when I'd say the real swimming, the serious swimming did start. That was when I was getting up before school, swimming, going home and swimming after school as well. So I think then, like, that it did get a lot harder, and like, it was still fun, but it started to get a bit more serious then. But that was when I saw the serious side of swimming and I thought, God, this is all going to pay off. I do want to go to the Paralympics now.
Those games, the World Dwarf Games in Belfast, sound like they were kind of an important moment, almost more in retrospect, where you can kind of trace back something growing inside you. How important was it, that representation? Obviously, the previous year you'd seen something on TV in Beijing that was important, and your mum and dad, I presume, were like, look at this, this is interesting. Mm. And they make the decision to bring you to Belfast, and it goes so well for you. But just that question of representation and actually seeing people like you competing and being part of that, how important was that for your development as an athlete and as a person?
Oh, it's massive. Like, as Emer said, I have experienced success, but I've also experienced, well, I won't call it failure, but like, before I went to the World Dwarf Games, I would enter into swimming competitions like across the local clubs, but the girls were twice the size of me, so like, they'd be a good body length ahead of me, and like back now I do it the whole time and I think nothing of it because I've achieved what I want to achieve. But I think back then all I saw was I wanted to win. And like when I didn't win, it was heartbreaking. So I think when I went to the World Dwarf Games and I was competing against people my own size and everyone who had experienced basically what I had experienced, I think it made a massive impact. And it kind of told me that everything was going to be okay. There are plenty, hundreds and thousands of people around the world just like me, and they seem to go on and live their life. And like Ellie Simmons, she went to a Paralympics and won her Paralympic medal. So I think that's where I saw that the dream could be real.
Eimear, a lot of people are wrestling with time deficits and busyness and the sense that they actually can't get involved. They'd like to get involved, but there's a blockage there. And sometimes it's excuses that we all make to ourselves to tell ourselves that we're far too busy to be involved. Sometimes it's a genuine fear of not knowing how to get involved in the first place. Do you have any advice for anybody watching this morning who would like to get involved in whatever it is that their local club is or that their kids are involved in, but just can't make that first leap?
Yeah, just get off the sofa and go up to that coach, person that's involved, chairperson, secretary, it doesn't matter, and just say you want to get involved. Because a coach can impact more young people in a year than an average person does in their lifetime. So if you feel that you have something that will impact a person's life, give positivity, get them off their butts, get them moving, go out there and do it. Because what's the point in sitting at home and regretting it, you know? That's my message. And this is such a fantastic award. There are 32 counties in Ireland. 32 clubs are going to receive €1,000 from this partnership with the EBS and the Federation of Irish Sport. And it's the third year they've done this. So I really say get out there and nominate your local club, hero. And if you want to be that hero, you can't do it if you're sitting at home. And it is such a fantastic feeling being a volunteer. You just, coaching is so fantastic. You kind of feel like people think that, you know, I'm going to be used. I'm, you know, it's got nothing to do with that. It's about how you feel about coaching. Like for me, my thank you is kids smiling and being happy and getting their own little bit of achievement. You know, if somebody learns to do a handstand and they've been trying for ages, I'll go home and think, hey, Mary learned to do a handstand today. That is just fantastic. So it's just the tiny little things. It's absolutely wonderful. So just get out there and become a volunteer.
It's a very powerful message, Eimear. Thanks a million for giving that to us this morning. Nicole, we haven't spoken to you since you got back from the Paralympics. How are you feeling now about the whole thing?
Now it's thankfully settling down. I think like getting to a Paralympics is a massive achievement, but I think getting a medal is another achievement in itself. And like going to Rio, like being so, I was half a second away from a bronze medal in Rio. And when I look back, like there was disappointment, but then I thought I can't really be disappointed with that. It was my first ever Paralympic Games and I was top five in the world. But then going into Tokyo, like I think, I wouldn't say there was a lot, well, I'd say there was a lot more pressure on me going into Tokyo because like I'd won a world bronze medal in 2019. So people were kind of like, I have stepped up on the world stage before. So going into Tokyo, I wouldn't say there was pressure and expectation, but I think it was more hope from myself and everyone else that I was going to win a medal. But I didn't really think anything of it until the race day. And then I think it gave me confidence when just after the heat, I qualified second fastest into the final, of which I thought I would have qualified third, if not fourth. So I think from the morning sim, I kind of knew if I gave it everything, I was in with a good chance for medal.
I'm sure winning the medal was amazing, Nicole, but nothing endorses an athlete more than two counties fighting over the identity of an athlete. So tell us, how did it feel to be in the middle of this diplomatic tension between County Leash and County Offaly?
I mean, she's I try not get involved. although my brother made it a bit worse. Well, he proved it when he wore an Offaly jersey on the TV. I say, like, technically, I do live in Offaly, of which when my mom and dad bought the house 20 years ago, they got told it was Leash. Until they saw Offaly flags up when there was a county final on or something, and they didn't. They only found out then that it was Offaly. We get our post quicker when we say leash. But we're about 200 metres from the river, so we're right on the border. So whichever county wants me, they can claim me.
It's a great thing to be for people to be fighting over it, and well deserved as well. Nicole, great to have you with us again, and thanks a million, and congratulations on your medal and everything else that's coming your ways too. And Emer, I think that was one of the most passionate and best exhortations we've ever had for people to get involved. So thanks to both of you this morning. It was a brilliant piece, and best of luck with everything. You. Cheers.
Thank you.
So the volunteersinsport.ie is the website, and as Emer pointed out there, they're going to give away €32,000, €1,000 to each of the counties. All you got to do is make sure that your nominations are in before this Sunday, October the 17th. OTBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors.
OTB AM
with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.